Today's episode of Rob's Podcast, talking with Zeke Smith, is sponsored by Denny's. Now, Denny's has always been a place where America can come and get their favorite breakfast, lunch, and dinner dishes, serving guests whatever they want, whenever they crave it. Now, with Denny's On Demand, they've taken the same always-open philosophy that is synonymous with the restaurant and applied it to online ordering, bringing access to the craveable Denny's dinner fare whenever guests want it. Thanks to the new platform, guests have a quick and easy way to place a mobile or online order for takeout or delivery of their favorite menu items all day, every day. And if having your favorite Denny's dish available at your fingertips 24/7, they've also partnered with Hulu to give guests a free 60-day trial of the premium streaming service. So for a limited time, users who place an order with Denny's On Demand will receive a complimentary Hulu trial and be able to enjoy their favorite meal while binge-watching thousands of hit shows, premium original content, films, and much more. With Denny's On Demand new online ordering, your diner favorites are at your fingertips. Visit Denny's.com and click to order online or download the Denny's app. Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cesternino getting you ready for my interview here with Zeke Smith, who came by the studio to chat with me about his two seasons of Survivor on Friday. So very much looking forward for you guys to hear what he had to say about everything. A busy week on the podcast coming up. Before we get into everything with Zeke, we have our 2000th episode right around the corner, so I'm excited for you all to hear that. And then we also announced the other day that we're going to be doing a Survivor Hot Takeoff, which we want to hear your hottest Survivor takes. So send those in to us for us to read on the show in our first ever Survivor Hot Take contest, where the winner will appear on a future episode of the Rob Has a Podcast voicemails. Maybe not a whole show, maybe just like, okay, let's check in and get the hot takes from the hot take winner about the new season of Survivor. Of course, that you could probably add a fourth H, the heroes, hustlers, healers, and hot takes. The show writes itself. But if you want to get your hot take in, again, we're looking for hot and we're looking for something that could actually be backed up. Tell us your take and then tell us why it is an accurate take. Send those in to hottake@robhasawebsite.com or hottakes@robhasawebsite.com. So looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say about that. And don't miss an episode by subscribing to the podcast, robhasawebsite.com/iTunes. I don't want to stop for a commercial interruption once we get talking with Zeke. So let me just quickly tell you guys about canvaspeople.com. We started talking about them about right before Mother's Day. I heard a lot of positive feedback about your experience with Canvas People. They've got a really great offer for you to try that you can get an 11 by 14 photo canvas, which is normally $69.99 plus shipping, for a special $0 offer. You just pay the shipping and handling. It works out to about less than $20 altogether, and you can get a great gift or item to hang up. They make a beautiful work of art out of any photo that you have, whether it's on your phone or digital camera. They can turn it into something really nice to hang up on the wall. Father's Day is around the corner. A lot of you guys checked out Canvas People for Mother's Day, but fathers, they want pictures of their kids as well. So don't forget about dad. Check out this offer with Canvas People. Nicole and I are very happy with the Canvas People photo that we ended up getting of the boys that we have hanging up downstairs. So check out this offer, the 11 by 14 photo canvas. Just go ahead and put that into your cart at the very end. Use promo code RHAP to get that special $0 pricing. That's the promo code RHAP at canvaspeople.com. That's canvaspeople.com. And with that, here you go. Here is my interview with Zeke Smith.
I'm so excited to be here, Rob. I've been listening to your podcast since like the early days when it was just you and Nicole like bickering and to be
and
in
still
the
is that
studio.
A lot.
Yes, it was. Yeah. I saw a little this morning. Which was, it was like watching your favorite television show live.
Come to life. And I'm very excited to get into everything here with you, but especially because we've had a lot of people who have been fans of the podcast who have gone onto the show, but I think that you are the OG. You are the person that dates back the furthest to what we were doing way back when. I met you in person. I think I was going back to 2012. So
yeah, I was a lot fatter then. I didn't have a mustache.
Yeah. And so the you are the genuine article.
Well, I think as far as RHAP fans go, I've notoriously written. I've been a blogger, and I think just two instances. I was a patron for many years. In fact, I only stopped being a patron before I left for Millennials Gen X and was turning off all of my auto pays.
Yeah, well, that's a good move. That's a good move.
I figured if I was going to be cannon fodder, I didn't need to pay for it anymore.
Right, right. Thank you. You've certainly made your contribution in terms of giving us stuff to talk about as well. So much appreciated. And that always gets a little weird where, you know, if somebody is a fan and they are, a patron, like I feel like it's almost like I feel like someone's like I'm like a newsman and like giving like political contributions. Like I don't want to like give the impression to people, hey, if you were a patron of the podcast, and then, you know, not to name names, some people have also, like, after they go play, they come on and want to be like a patron. Like, no, this is, we have too much integrity here.
Right. Well, I mean, I was a fan because I love, yes, the podcast and I love what you have to say. And I think signing up to play meant, you know, signing up for whatever you might throw at me. So, mm-hmm.
Okay.
I have to say, and I think this is a good advice for all players, don't listen to podcasts when your season is airing.
Right.
Don't listen to the commentary. Don't read your Twitter feed. Don't read any of the fan sites. Just spend time with your family.
Did you feel this way going back through? And of course, you had this completely surreal experience with this last season. But did you feel that same way back in Millennials versus Gen X too?
Yeah. Well, I think I had such a unique Survivor experience because I played my All-Star season and got to learn so much about what it meant to have this other half of the Survivor experience, because half of it's playing and the best half is playing and starving and living in the dirt. And then the other half, which is the less exciting experience, is watching it air and having people comment at you and becoming part of this like Survivor alumni network.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned all about that.
It's a lot.
Right,
it's a lot.
Playing Game Changers. And I just took in what everyone said about me and I was like, dear God, like, I cannot be reading anything people are writing about me.
Mm-hmm.
I came home and I blocked all the, like, on no device of mine can you get on the Survivor subreddit, which I hear is a good thing for me.
Yeah. So sometimes the fans and everybody's talking that, you know, that they could sort of like get like a dog with a bone on one thing, and then it's like it's hard. How do you change the narrative on that stuff? But as somebody who was a fan coming into this whole experience, how hard is that for you to? Because I think that a lot of people have sort of like the, you know, wish fulfillment of, I'm a super fan. I don't want to say super duper fan because I'm not talking about Adam.
Don't dare put me in the same category as Adam Klein.
But that the super fan, I think, dreams of going on to the show, and then that the, you know, Greek chorus of podcasts and Reddit and Twitter and Facebook are all going to say, what a genius. This person, this is, you know, God's gift to Survivor. Finally, the chosen one has come, and they don't, I don't think, really have the foresight to say, okay, now I will be the object of scorn, you know, in the same way that I'm talking about, like, these idiots. Then there's also something to be, you know, the person who's now, like, the shoe is on the other foot.
Yeah, I would say that's a big shift that I've definitely felt over the past year and a half, going from being, you know, fanboy to being, you know,
fan man,
I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Growing up on, well, to being a player. And I think there is, when you become a player, it's everything's different. I guess my Survivor experience, I mean, ended about a week ago, after like an intense year and a half. So maybe there will be a recalibration, and who knows, in 35, 36, maybe I'll like become the fanboy I once was. But I think, you know, you see Survivor from the inside. And I think the biggest shift for me is when I was, even though I knew a lot of former players, you still, in some degree, you know, you watch a television show, and it doesn't matter that, you know, it's a reality show and you know these are real people having a real experience. To some extent, they're still the same as like characters in a scripted sitcom, right? They're just these two-dimensional television characters. Yeah. And you don't quite make the full connection that these are real people having an experience that's going to change their lives. And I think I have so much more, I think, compassion for anything anyone has done on Survivor. Like, I don't even know that I'm going to, if I ever come back and do a recap, I might be a pretty crappy recapper, because I'm like, how can I fault anyone for anything that they did? Because everyone is doing their best and trying to make the best decision and operating like at their highest. Like, everyone's trying really hard. Yeah.
I feel like Hannah came out and said something similar, like coming out of last season, where I think when I talked to her at the finale, she's like, I'm never going to say anything about, and not that she does that now, but I do feel like, you know, and I saw her at the finale and she came through here to do the podcast, that I think she was sort of like, you know, she was a little bit like more able to let loose, even like at the beginning of the season when we did sort of like the overall cast, like we did the Beyond the Buff show, and she was like very, you know, PC about everybody at that point. Like, I do think that as time goes on, it's sort of like, you know, you sort of like you'll come to terms with like the further away you get from playing.
Sure. But part of me like hopes not. Part of me hopes I can just root for everybody.
It's tough. It's tough. So first, how's everything going for you in the week or so since we came from the finale?
Great. You know, I'm my life's like really exciting right now.
Yeah.
I'm about to move to LA. I'm going to leave this podcast and go sign a lease on a place.
Sign a leasey.
Yeah. There we go. We've got to put a bell over here so I can ding
you
one.
You want
at
a bell
some
also?
Point.
I will.
That's the dream,
you,
is to ding a bell,
yes,
on RHAP.
For you today, I will do this, but I wouldn't trust most people because they get overexcited and they just like ding crazy like a baby. There you go. That was the Zeke bell here today. We call that the Rachel Riley, where they just like are constantly like, I have to keep it away from the reaches of the guest for the most part.
Yes.
But you can handle it.
I have bell appreciation.
Yes.
I feel like I've also like spent so much time on RHAP fans now. I could never like do them the disservice of overbelling.
Okay. Well, yeah, that'll get you, you know, you'll be that Dan Bueno will rip you apart in the comments for over dinging the bell. Okay. So you're signing a lease. You're moving out here. You're coming out west.
Coming out west. Got a bunch of exciting stuff in the hopper that, you know, when it becomes a little more, you know, real and cemented, I would love to come talk about. But yeah.
A tease.
The future's bright.
Okay. All right. Well, Zeke, that I talked to Aubrey about a week ago, and that she was like a similar situation to you where she didn't play back-to-back, but for all intents and purposes, she played one season, then she left before we got a chance to talk to her about her first season, and then played on this season. And that's sort of like, so there's so much to cover with you, and I know it's a little like it's almost like that the snake is eats its tail, and it's a little bit like old is new and new is old. So I don't even know where to begin, but I guess if you could start with like, how did you get into this? But I know you were listening to RHAP at one point. You talked about in the reunion show about how you first discovered Survivor,
right? I was taking some time away from school. I was like really depressed. I just got out of a terrible relationship, and my brother, actually, I was living with him, and my brother and I, we don't get along. And I was like, what's something?
Older brother or younger brother?
Older brother.
Okay.
And I was like, what's something that I can watch so we can have something to talk about and not just fight all the time? And he's like, well, I'm really into Survivor. And I was like, that show's still on? Like, oh my God, like this is so dumb. And he was like, you know, start with, it was Cook Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And Cook Islands is a very special place in my heart. That I got to play with Ozzy is like, that's a pretty big deal for me. And I like, every time I see Ozzy, I'm like, it's just such a dream come true that we're friends, man. Anyway, sorry, big nerd. So yeah, you know, binged a ton of RHAP.
You know, it wasn't all about Ozzy.
There you go.
Sorry.
Yeah, I just watched you do a Penner impression. That's kind of cool.
So
binged a ton of Survivor. And I think I did my big binge, right? It was like the 2 months after Heroes versus Villains had aired.
Okay, so Cook Islands was the first season
first
you watched,
season I watched,
but
it was the
Cook
first
was
season
on.
Yeah, on iTunes at the time.
Got it.
And then I watched everything on iTunes and then went back and got DVDs and then watched stuff on YouTube. And I spent like, you know, June and July binging Survivor, and then I had like a month before I think Nicaragua started, which, God, that was a disappointing season to like come back on. Like, I became a huge Survivor fan, and then I hit that like spurt of like terrible seasons. But I, you know, I was always looking for more, and I, you know, was Googling stuff about Survivor, and RHAP was in its early iterations, and I started listening, and you and Nicole were, you're sort of like my buddies I listened
to. So did you watch Survivor at all in the, you know, the real heyday early on and then like got away from it? Or you never even like it wasn't something that you knew anything about before your brother turned you on to it?
Well, I remember I was in middle school when Borneo aired. I think, yeah, I remember watching Hatch win. I remember that my high school's my school's homecoming theme was Survivor. And we had like an outwit, outlast, outplay, like homecoming shirt. And I watched the premiere of Australia, but I never really got into it. But I remember that cultural moment and was sort of participated in it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, never really paid much more attention.
Being somebody who was such a big fan of all the seasons before you played with the All-Stars, did that mess you up at all in terms of like you talk about like, oh, my God, there's Ozzy. But I know for me, I feel like that it was somewhat similar to go and play in the All-Stars where I had played in my season, but it's one thing when you're playing with people who are strangers, you don't know them from anything. And then I feel like that it really was something that I was like, oh, hey, there's Sue Hawk and there's Boston Rob, who I, you know, loved watching on the TV. Like, it was hard for me to sort of like, you know, I wanted those people to like me also.
Yeah, it definitely took a couple days for me to adjust out there on the beach. And I think there were a couple of things. I felt a lot of pressure, and I maybe put too much pressure on myself to be like, you're part of Survivor Game Change, right? And like that, right. Like I think the fanboy in me like built it up to be, I think, more than it should have. And then I was nervous talking to these people who are my like Survivor celebrities. Mm-hmm. And eventually after a couple of days, you know, everything's the same and you calm down. But I think one thing that because I played back to back and didn't have that experience of having the real thing and contrasting that with what makes the television show, you know, in my mind, the people I was playing with were the characters I saw on television, and there's such a disconnect. Like, I knew very well the games as I'd seen them play out on television, but that is very different than I think the real game and the real person as they are on the beach.
Okay.
I knew everyone's big moves and game-changing moments, but often there's a couple of steps between A and Z, mm-hmm. and I think that was a bad headspace for me to be in. Z for Zeke, yeah.
So at what point did you decide, I want to go and get on the show? And did you get on the first try, or was it like a long conversation with them over seasons?
Actually, the first thing I applied to do on Survivor was be a Dream Teamer.
Yeah.
And I got denied from being a Dream Teamer twice.
No, why?
I don't know.
What are the qualifications for being a Dream Teamer? Do they want somebody who's like really physical? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think someone who's fit, someone who's young, someone who wants to have a future in film and television production.
People on the challenges. Yeah.
I don't know. Whenever I see Kierhofer, I'm like, oh, it's a good thing you denied me, Kierhofer. Yeah. And he's like, isn't it? But I don't know. I think one of the great shifts of shifting from fan to player is that you really appreciate how incredible everyone is who makes Survivor and their passion and how good they are at what they do. Mm-hmm. So look, I've had an incredible Survivor experience, but part of me is like often wistful for the alternate timeline when I like become a person who works on Survivor.
Yeah.
Applied to be a Dream Teamer twice. That didn't work out. And then I think 3 or 4 years later, I was hanging out with Andrea Bucky and Alex Forstenhausler. Mm-hmm.
But could you just back up a little bit? So, I mean, you're this person, you have this incredible education. Did you go to Harvard for undergraduate?
Harvard for undergraduate. My degree is actually like in biblical interpretation.
Okay.
My degree's in religion.
And again, I don't know, you know, what the marketplace is for that. but it just that, I mean, did you get any sort of like pushback from your family in terms of like, hold on, you know, you have this amazing education and you want to go test competitions for a game show?
Well, I don't think I had
and not to disparage any Dream Teamers that are out there,
right? I mean, look, I sent an email.
I know they listen. I'm just saying that
the Dream Teamers are awesome.
Yeah.
Ryan, you know who you are. Mm-hmm. It never got super serious. I don't even know that I ever told my mom or my dad that I was applying to be a Dream Teamer on Survivor. Well, I actually PA'd out of college. I did work in film and television out of college. I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. Ended up sort of...
So you felt like it was a foot in the door to something in an industry that you wanted to get into.
Right. And I also loved Survivor.
Yeah.
And wanted... I think I have always wanted to be part of Survivor, but I think because of like the nature of my story, felt like I don't... know that I could. Because I think you have to understand, this was also in like 2010, 2011. This was a very different time, like for trans people in particular. And I also was like a very different person back then. I was not, I think, the like kind of like eccentric, well-spoken, you know, confident person that you saw.
Right.
And being on camera was not really something but I wanted to be part of Survivor. So I thought I'll be a dream teamer.
Mm-hmm.
And then that didn't work out. But I started doing, between that and applying to be on the show, I did a game of Big Brother Brooklyn, hosted by Jeffrey Marks from Glass House.
Yes. The Jeffrey Marks.
Yes, in which I went to the end with Matt Pavlovich,
mm-hmm.
the executive producer of Survivor Brooklyn, now Survivor LA.
But this was pre-Glass House, right? Post-Glass House?
This was post-Glass House.
Oh, the PGH era.
Yeah. And I went to the end with him and lost by one vote.
You were not the primetime Alex Stein of Glass House / Big Brother Brooklyn.
No, I don't know. I didn't even watch the end of the Glass House. I don't know who came in second. But that Big Brother Brooklyn story is a fun story. Well, we won't get into it. It's not for a family audience.
Okay.
But yeah, I went to the end, lost by one vote. There were people who felt like he had shined more, that his game was a little more apparent than mine, and I'd sort of excelled in challenges and other things.
It was a real Brad versus Sarah decision.
Right. Though the way I offended the jury was a little bit different than the way Brad did. We'll just say it was an entire house of gay guys.
Yeah.
And there was an HOH room. I'll let you fill in the blanks.
Okay.
So I did that, and then met Pav, and he invited me to do the now infamous Survivor Brooklyn season.
Yes.
Where I met Andrea and Sophie, and two guys who are really good friends of mine and big RHAP fans, Mikey Harlow and Alex Forstenhausler.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I talk about how I did in these games is because it influences my philosophy and how I played Survivor.
Survivor Brooklyn 4 is the Pearl Islands of Survivor Brooklyn. That people, they just talk about that like, oh, that cast, everything.
Yeah, it was a real fun day. And I think how I went out in Survivor Brooklyn, if you didn't watch, I was in a real tight alliance with this guy named Danny and with Sophie Clark. And we, at the merge, we were joining up with Andrea's, you know, group, and Andrea and Alex's group wanted to make a move against our group, our, you know, voting block, shall we say. And I think they didn't want to get Andrea out because Andrea was like a good meat shield, and Danny won immunity. So I just sort of got picked off. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't ever get to make a move or have a chance to play. It just, where I was in the alliance, I was the person to vote for.
Yeah.
So, you know, the first time I played, I wasn't shiny enough. And the second time I played, I never got a chance to shine. Hence why I think my MO now is to like go big mid jury.
Yeah.
To make sure I always have my chance to have a moment that you saw that I was playing.
Was there anything that you saw from playing with Andrea in Survivor Brooklyn that you feel like, did you see anything in her game from playing with it? Like, was that any sort of a help at all in the real Survivor game? Like, you had that experience with her?
I didn't play a ton with Andrea. Okay. I played more with Sophie.
Because the merge happened and then you just got picked off at the merge.
Right.
But she did go on, and you were on the jury and you watched her the rest of that season. So
I think the thing I remember most.
Is it so apples and oranges?
We're talking about a day in a park in Brooklyn 4 years ago. I barely remember seasons of Real Survivor. What I remember most distinctly from both Sophie and Andrea was how intense they were,
mm-hmm.
was how seriously they took. For me, like, you know, I had a flask of whiskey in my backpack that I was passing around. And like, I actually don't think I'd watched Survivor in about a year. This was around the time Cagayan aired. And like, I remember Alex trying to convince me to watch Survivor again. I was just there, mm-hmm. like hanging out. But the intensity and focus with which they approached the game and how every interaction meant something to them, that's what I noticed. And I was like, so if that's what it takes to play, like, is that constant intensity.
Okay. So from there, then.
So about a year later, I was watching Big Brother because we were cheering on Meg Maley.
Yes.
At a bar in Midtown with Alex, Mikey, and Andrea. And It was a really exciting time for me because I started watching Survivor again. Cagayan got me back into it. And it was like weeks after the second chances vote and like everyone had been sent out. And we were all the tribe lists had been leaked and we were looking at the tribes and like we were worried about Steven. We're like, how's Steven going to do on this tribe? Like, can he get with this person or that person? We didn't think he was on a great tribe for his interests. But I just remember how excited I was and how much I just wanted to play and wanted to go out there. And Andrea was like, you should apply. Mm-hmm. You should do it. You know, you could get cast. Like, you should do it. God, doesn't she regret that? and I was sort of like, oh, I don't know. And then I remember walking home from the bar that night and being like, why not? Like, why not apply?
Right.
This would be really cool. You could do it. I think you would have interesting ideas. And then I about a month later, I made a video. I kind of dragged my feet and edited it. And sent it in and received a call from casting 2.5 hours later. Before I knew it, I was in LA for finals and then on a plane to Fiji.
What did you tell them in the video?
Well, I talked about being a high school debater. I talked about, you know, I wasn't, people like tried to bully me in high school and I was just meaner back to them. And I talked about that sort of like approaching bullying with bullying.
Yeah.
I talked about my job. I talked about being an RHAP fan.
Mm-hmm. Did that land or no?
I think it did because I'm sort of eccentric and weird. And I actually wore the shirt that I wore on Millennials versus Gen X in my video. And I think they're like, God, is this guy like, is he trying to like affect some character? And I was like, no, I actually know quite a bit about Survivor. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing, here's the advice. People ask me all the time about casting. And I think that it's less about having a good story than it is about being a good storyteller. Mm-hmm. They watch a million 3-minute videos a day. You have to pop. Because I think the thing that is important to remember about Survivor is that it's, at its heart, it's a television show. And that they want people who are good television. Mm-hmm. Like someone, I think especially people who listen to this podcast think, well, I can prove I have good knowledge. I have these outdoor skills or I have a good background or a good story. Sometimes all you need to be is electric. Like Michaela didn't know anything about Survivor.
Right.
She was a fan favorite and made great television. Like I remember being on the Millennial Beach with Michaela. We'd been there for a few days and she goes, oh, so this is not like an athletic competition. And I was like, no, no, it's not. But I think everyone appreciates Michaela's contributions to Survivor. And I also think in her third iteration, you know, she's very smart and she's learned a lot. I think she'll be a tremendous player a third time.
Yeah, she could be one of those interesting players like a Parvati who goes on to learn the game as they continue to play it. Tyson is that same sort of thing. Just to speak to the advice in terms of casting, I had seen this tweet yesterday. This was somebody asked Penner on Twitter, at Survivor Penner. This is from Mr. Entertainment, a.k.a. at Real Joey Barone, says, sir, I will be making my Survivor audition tape in the near future. Any tips and recommendations? He said, be gorgeous, an athlete, or interesting AF.
Yeah, no, I would say that's, yep.
That sounds... Sage words from Penner.
Yep. And when if anyone calls, or if you ever get to go to LA and do the finals, the thing that I had to learn was just to walk in and own a room and be confident. Like, I think before Survivor, I used to be very kind of shy and ask for permission and like not like be like big and bold. And that's what you can't do. If you ever get a call from a blocked number, right, or walk into a room where Jeff Probst is, just be like your coolest, most electric self, even if it's a bit of a put on, because you'll learn to inhabit it.
Right.
And also, if any former or if any RHAP fans become players, your relationships at the casting, they matter. Pay attention to who's there. Try to have good, try to have a good rapport with people. Like Chris and I's Boomer Sooner connection began in casting when I was wearing an OU football shirt. And then the next time I saw Chris, he was wearing an OU football shirt and we were winking and we were that connection started there. Same with my connection with Sunday. We were on the same floor. We would wait for the elevator together. And I was just really polite to Sunday.
Just try to find one thing with each person. You don't know who's going to be on your tribe.
Yeah. And most of the millennials were actually at one casting. Most of the Gen Xers were at another casting, and that matters, that you have these like prior relationships with people even before you get to wherever you're going. That will have an impact on the game.
Now, Were there a lot of questions for you? I'm assuming that you told them during the casting process that you were a trans person.
Right.
Did you feel like that they were really trying to steer you in any sort of direction with that?
No. I mean, the first time I met with Jeff, we didn't talk about it, right? Because that was sort of my deal. I didn't talk about it in my video. It was like me for me, and then we could talk about this other thing. Mm-hmm. And I made it past round one, and I went to round two, and I was, you know, about midway through the conversation, I was like, oh, hey, this is a thing. And, you know, Jeff just sort of like, he like put down his notebook and he like looked me dead in the eyes, got really intense, which he does. And he's like, if, how, and when you ever want to talk about this part of your life, it's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the long and the short of it until, you know, I guess the caveat to his statement was, you know, if someone else brings it up or it arises in another, you know, scenario, then it will be part of your, you know, your story in the show. And that's something I knew and appreciated walking in, but we just had this agreement that this is how we were going to handle it. And, you know, when things changed, we came up with a new strategy of how to handle it moving forward.
Yeah. And yet you talked about you were watching Big Brother 17 at the time that you decided to put in your casting tape. And
right.
Of course, you know, Big Brother fans know that Audrey and her story was such a big part of Big Brother 17. And that was sort of handled in a much different way by the network in terms of like going out, with her being part of it, of like, hey, this that meet Audrey, she's part of this season. And that was, I'm sure, something that you must have been thinking about how that was handled, because you chose to go in a completely different direction.
Yeah, definitely. And I have to say, you know, Audrey's appearance on Big Brother was definitely something that, you know, it was sort of me looking at how CBS handled it. How is this going to be? How well was it going to be received? You know, how well was it going to be received on the podcast?
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of the litmus test, because I didn't want to be like the first. And I was like, well, everyone, I wanted to do it differently than she did. Audrey and I, we've tweeted a bit at each other, but we've never met. I think she's great and awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I think I approach my life a little differently than she does. And I wanted my survivor experience to be more about like me as a survivor mm-hmm. player and less about like this part of my life that I really didn't used to talk about.
The irony though, is that they handled it, you know, much more like an announcement on the show, but because of her gameplay was so, you know, all over the place, like it really very quickly became sort of a thing that was like in the rearview mirror, because people were like, oh my God, what is she doing now? What is she doing now?
Right.
It really ended up by the time, like, and she wasn't on for a long time, like 3 or 4 weeks, that it was almost like something you forgot about by the time, because of just the everything she was doing game wise.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, everybody comes into a reality show season with like a character type and a story, but those all fall by the wayside once the game picks up and once you have like the season story.
Mm-hmm.
Being on Survivor for me was a bit bigger deal than I think most people, and the way it was going to sort of change the basic configuration of my life.
Right.
I mean, I never imagined it would in the scale that it did.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, if you're going to go do this, you have to make this experience relevant, whether or not you're voted out. Like, if you're voted out first, how is this a worthwhile endeavor for you? So I really, like, you know, I made a lot of goals. I was like, I'm going to work out a ton and lose a bunch of weight and like learn about a lot about like mental toughness techniques and all this other stuff. And I thought about like what I wanted to get out of it, you know, personally as an experience. And that often guided me out there. It was like, make the most of this. This is incredible. This is like a one-time thing,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, a whatever time thing, potentially. And I think I wanted to go out and play Survivor and really appreciate every moment and have a ton of fun. And I think I got so much out of it because that's the attitude that I went in with, and would encourage other people to like think about, what do you personally want to get out of it? Because you're probably not going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't win, if you get voted out first, make it worthwhile. Yeah. And I think, you know, at Casting Probe said to me, he was like, you know, you're not going to win, right? And I was like, yeah, you have a 95% chance of losing. And he said, okay, hold on to that and let that free you to go play and mm-hmm. go like make a splash. And
does he say that to everybody, or he felt like that was an important message for you?
I don't know. I don't know if anyone else got that advice. I feel like that's pretty, like, I feel like he says that a lot, like
mm-hmm.
forget about winning, just go play. And I love that's mm-hmm. how I approach the game. So that was sort of me going in, and yeah, then before you know it, like you're on a plane with 19 crazy people, and you're, you know, you go to Ponderosa, you're in pregame, and that's a pretty surreal experience. But I, you know, I, because you're, you know, like as a fan, like, you know, Survivor, but you also have no idea of what it is, mm-hmm. right? You're just embarking into the unknown. And I remember the night before we got marooned, we were, you're in the, these tents. So everyone's separated and sleeping in tents. And they sent us to bed early because we knew, you know, next day was D-Day. And then a couple hours later, everyone, like, you know, it's pouring down rain. It's winding, like the wind's coming so hard that our tents are getting ripped up. And they come and say, it's too dangerous for being in the tents. Like, grab your mattress, we're moving you inside. And I remember remarking to one of our handlers, I was like, what happens tomorrow night? And mm-hmm. she just laughed at me.
Right.
Right. But you have this, like, you know, already the elements are too dangerous for you to be in tents. And then nobody, I mean, nobody slept that night. A couple hours later, they wake you up and you take your last shower. You put on your Survivor, I call it your costume. Mm-hmm. You know, it's your clothes that you sent in, but it becomes your, you know, your kind of Survivor identity. It's, you know, someone reaches their hand down your boxers to make sure you're not wearing two pairs of underwear. And then yeah. you eat your last meal. And then you walk down a pier and you get on a boat and no one tells you where you're going. You just are driven off to the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then for millennials, Gen X, you know, we got from one boat to another boat. And then there's all of a sudden there's a camera in your face. And it's like, well, there's no turning back now, right? Because at any point up until then, you can opt out without it being a quit, right? I mean, not that they wouldn't fight you for it, but...
The Melissa McNulty?
Right. Is she the one who quit before Fiji?
Honestly, I don't know at what point in the process. I think that I think that's the name.
Yeah. But like at that point, like you're on Survivor. Right. And I remember we were on these boats and they're just chasing rainstorms to get us wet.
Were you thinking about walking away at any point?
No. I mean, I was very excited to do it, but there was just always this like, it becomes final. Like there's no turning back
right.
now.
Point
like
of no return.
Right. And we were on these boats and going over these like, huge, you know, walls of water and, you know, you're just soaked immediately. And then, you know, they're like, all right, we're going to pull these dinghies up onto a beach and you're going to walk up the hill and you'll see Jeff Probst and then he'll tell you what to do. And you do, you get off the boat and you see Probst and you're just like, what the hell do we do now? And he tells you what to do. But you see Probst, and behind him is just a wall of cameras.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it felt like a million cameras. I'm sure it was only like, you know, 15, 20. But it hits you in a way that this experience is so much bigger than you could have ever conceptualized going in. There's no way to prepare yourself mentally for what you're about to encounter. But it's also the most like amazing thing ever.
You were on the season with the millennials and the Gen Xers, and you yes. were part of the millennial tribe. I always felt that you were sort of like the reluctant millennial, the millennial in age. Is that how you've actually felt as a person, or do you feel like that was something that you just sort of like put on as a character?
Oh, no, that's definitely how I felt. I remember because you know by what colors you're wearing that morning, what tribe you're going to be on. And I walk in with my like bright yellow jacket and I look for Chris and Sunday and Brett, who are the people I really wanted to work with. And they're all wearing dark clothes. And then all the like hot kids who kept like chatting with each other in mm-hmm. pregame, like Figgy and Taylor and Michelle and Jay are all in my colors. And I'm just like, we're divided by age. I mean, I didn't know it was millennials, Gen X at that point, but I was just like, we're divided by age. Like I'm screwed. Like this is the worst possible scenario because I don't get along with like young people.
You already said you don't like Survivor Nicaragua.
I already
that
said,
was the other age divided season other than these ones where it's like a Cook Island, but you liked
Exile Island.
Yeah, Exile Island. Cook Islands is totally different.
Yeah. That was also a weird way to start. Like I'm surprised I stuck with Survivor starting with Survivor Race Wars.
Yeah.
But at the time I was just kind of like, but you know, they swapped out of it quickly enough. Anyway, yeah, I remember feeling like all the social anxiety, which I typically was able to fight through so much a part of Survivor, just all came flooding back to me. And I became very self-conscious. And also, like, I'm not someone who thinks of myself as a millennial. And you know, we got divided into tribes. And I remember I unwrapped my buff and I looked at the theme and I was like, millennials versus Gen X. God, this is terrible. Also, am I a millennial?
Yeah.
And then I was like, I must be. And then Jeff started asking us all of these questions about the difference between millennials and Gen Xers, which is not a topic I'd ever considered ever before in my entire life. But also, you don't want to be standing on the mat with a tribe and be like, these mofos, like, I'm not a millennial. These guys suck. Millennials are terrible, right? You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, whenever he asked me a question, I was just like, what the heck am I going to say? Because I didn't, yeah. And I came up with something or another, but that's also a Survivor skill, is being able to answer Jeff's questions like confidently, even though you have no idea what you're talking about.
It is a interesting skill set in terms of, like, you don't normally, if you're an average person, you don't have, like, press conferences where people are just throwing, like, pointed questions at you that you have to sort of, like, answer artfully. I mean, I guess sort of like certainly in the corporate world, but if you're like the average like 24-year-old, I don't know how many times, like, you know, you're being asked those types of questions.
Right, especially
on
when,
TV.
Exactly. And I mean, I think one of the incredible and one of the really intoxicating parts of Survivor is that what you say matters and that you are listened to. You are listened to both by your tribe mates who, you know, are processing and, you know, making analyses of anything that comes out of your mouth, but also that could potentially like be on television and like millions of people are going to see that. And really,
idiot podcasters will talk about.
Exactly.
Put on a soundboard.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
I think it
depends who you ask.
Yeah. I have to, you know, shout out names of other podcasters on this podcast in order to make the soundboard.
Josh Wiggler.
There we go.
There you go.
But you know, I ended up in my early days, like kind of leading the construction of the shelter and making the fire and tending the fire and being like the alpha male sort of the camp, which is not a position I ever anticipated being in. I kind of felt I was going to go out there and I wanted to have enough skills to be able to keep up with, you know, anybody who was doing anything.
Did you have that background? Had you camped or anything like that before?
Yeah, I mean, I camped and stuff. I actually bought, I spent $80 buying a bundle of bamboo poles from Home Depot.
Okay.
And I bought a machete to like learn to work with bamboo. And I learned, you know, I did practice making the fire.
Oh, wow, look at you.
Yeah, my fire escape. Actually, those bamboo poles are still on my fire escape. And before I move, I have to get rid of them some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just, you know, I watched a bunch of videos. There's this YouTube channel called Jungle Crafty, which will teach you everything you need to know for Survivor.
Wow.
I just wanted to be capable in whatever I did. All that ended up paying off. In its own way. I mean, I was sort of the crotchety old man on the millennial camp, but I have to say, the most fun days of Survivor were with the millennials. Like, yeah, we were just running around chasing goats and being ninjas and doing dirty charades on the beach, and we just had an absolute blast. And I wish I could have appreciated it a little more.
Yeah, give us some stories from the millennial tribe. We've talked a lot about this tribe. I think Steven has been so hyperbolic to call it the greatest tribe ever. I think it's tough when you factor in some of the all-star tribes, but in terms of like first-time players.
New player season, yeah. I don't think you're going to find 10 more dynamic Survivor players, right?
Yeah, like, there's not a dud there.
No, not a single person. Like, everyone could play again. Everyone's fun in confessionals. Like, yeah, a really, really bomb-ass tribe. And I think, you know, I didn't anticipate how hard and fast everyone was going to play. Like, I sort of approached it having analyzed so many seasons of Survivor being like, oh, well, like, you can't play too hard. And then I was like, no, everyone's playing harder than you, and you just got blindsided, and you need to pick it up, dude. Yeah, well, I think, you know, that our first night, you know, we got on that shelter, and it didn't hold anybody. I was on it when it crashed into the mud. And actually, before even that, I mean, we saw the rain clouds coming and the sun setting, and we all just decided to take a dip in the water before bedtime. So we were all wet and we were laying out, and then it started to rain and we got in the shelter and the shelter broke. And then that was the longest night of my life in the pouring rain in
this
the mud.
Night one.
Night one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Survivor boot camp. It was like, no one's coming to save you. This is real. You're going to be cold and wet and just huddled together in the mud throughout this. And that was a crazy way to start. But then we got evacuated the next day. And the fun evacuation story is we got taken to this like cement room that had five army blankets. So everyone has to pair up, but nobody wants to, I think, reveal any relationships. So you just hop down next to the whoever it is. But we all took we stripped down to our undies to let the rest of our clothes dry.
Yeah.
And I end up in my underwear under a blanket, huddled next to Will Wall in his underwear.
Yeah.
And just remember thinking like 6 months ago, this would have been illegal. And like, this kid's about to have an experience. And I did, like, I slept on the cement floor, like, yeah, snuggling Will Wall all night.
Hey, that body heat, skin to skin, that's what they do in hypothermia cases.
Right. You know, it's Survivor. You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a couple nights later, we made a big bonfire on the beach and played dirty charades. Mm-hmm. And there was just a sense that Survivor was fun,
yeah,
which was not a vibe you know, whenever there I was on a tribe with millennials, there was the vibe that Survivor was fun. But that was certainly not a vibe that was in 34. That this is like, this is an insane experience and we need to appreciate it.
I definitely get that from you because I feel like that in the way that you talk about Survivor 34 and obviously everything that happened with you in that season, I just feel like that there's like a gravitas, like a weight that's on you like regarding that season. But it, just like seeing you talk about millennials versus Gen X, like I definitely like get the sense of like a lightness about it and sort of like the like fond memories of these crazy people that I would, as opposed to these crazy people, you know?
Yeah, I would say the 33 days I played in season 33 were 33 of the best days of my life. I had so much fun. Mm-hmm. I was playing this game I loved with people who also loved the game. And you get to make the... You know, the fun part of Survivor, if you're, you know, you're doing it right, is you don't talk about, you know, what, I don't forget what, which one of Bloomberg's numbers this is, but you don't talk about politics, religion, or other controversial beliefs.
I think it's Rule 5.
Rule 5. And we really did that on 33. And I got to connect with people like Sunday Berquist, who I love Sunday so much. She's such an amazing woman. And, you know, I think there's, A, there's no other time in life where I would have met her. And B, I think if we would have met under any other circumstance, we would have just been like, oh, we're not the same type of people. We can't be friends. Mm-hmm. But we, I had such a blast connecting with her and getting to know her. And I'm glad that I have all these people
in my
life.
What was it about her? You mentioned her as somebody that you sort of connected with in casting.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I'm a guy, I'm from Oklahoma, so I feel, you know, I have that Midwest, and I think I have this like sense of manners and etiquette is very important to me. And Sunday and I both love to throw parties. And I think we both
throw parties.
Yeah, we throw the best parties. I mean, I think my like Dolly Parton Redneck Christmas probably has a few items at that party that are not at Sunday's usual mm-hmm. parties. But we, you know, you make a Jello mold, you make a Jello shot. It's still the same, same ingredients, right? So yeah, we just, you know, found that we had a lot in common. I, you know, she reminded me of my mother, and you know, obviously Brett and I had such a great connection, and you know, that was one of my favorite days on Survivor. The challenge was, we're going to talk about like the coming out moment. So the challenge was on this sand spit. It's on this dollop of sand in the middle of this like crystal clear Fijian ocean. And, you know, there are only like 4 hours of the day where you can, the tides are low enough where you can be on this hunk of sand in the middle of, there's not an outlet. There's nothing. It's a hunk mm-hmm. of sand in the middle of the ocean. And it's for the helicopter award, which is like something I'd never been on a helicopter. And like, that was on my bucket list, like be on a helicopter on Survivor. And it's this nutty challenge, which I don't know, is fulfilling some sort of, you know, Probst S&M fantasy where we're all like buckled with bondage cloths with our, you know, ankles together and our wrists to our hips. And you got to wriggle through the sand being snakes. And we were behind, but we like get it back on the puzzle. And then, you know, we win. It's very exciting. We're on the helicopter. It's great. I'm with Dave, who I'm now like going to war against, and we're both fighting for Brett and Sunday, and it just feels so mm-hmm. like epic. And then we get out there for the reward. And the thing about the rewards is, at least my strategy was to eat to the point right below the threshold of throwing up, right? So like stuff yourself as much as possible.
Yeah. But it sneaks up on you.
It does. You got to be careful. And you know, I'm getting hosed with Brett too, right? Cause Brett wants to drink and nobody wants to drink alone. So I'm like, I'm going to drink with Brett. And we're, so I'm like, I'm drunk. I'm about to throw up. So I'm like taking my clothes off and going and rolling in like the cold ocean to cool my body temperature down. So
does
I don't
work?
Throw up. It does.
Yeah.
You got to just bring that body temperature down. It will prevent okay. you going.
Good to know.
So I'm like about to barf, a little drunk, and Brett and Dave leaves and Sunday leaves, and Brett's like, hey buddy. And I'm like, You just felt like the shift in the energy, like you felt the camera guys like moving a little closer, like you saw a producer out of the corner of your eye be like, we have a Brett coming out to Zeke, we have a Brett coming out to Zeke, you know, like that this was a moment and it was gonna make air, and you got to push back like the barf and the drunkenness and like be there and be present.
Yeah, because probably, you know, not as great of a moment if he comes out to you and then you immediately start getting sick.
Right.
Like, that's not a TV moment at any point.
Well,
now.
Not even not a TV moment, but like, you know, Brett is like sharing something very important to me. This is a big moment in Brett's life. And I wanted to be there for Brett because I love Brett and I, you know, I really care for him. And I was like, this is important for him.
The nicest guy, by the way.
Oh, the best guy.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was such a lovely conversation. And I think what's so interesting is, you know, like everyone, we've been like rolling our eyes at this constant insistence on talking about the difference between millennials and Gen Xers, mm-hmm. right? That like at every tribal council, you're, you know, sort of poked like, well, is this a difference between generations? You're like, oh God. But that naturally in that conversation, it arose, mm-hmm. right? Like we didn't need to be prompted. I don't know if that's because we'd been talking about it so much, it was just at the forefront of our minds, or if it was just like, you know, a natural, you know, part of the, you know, who we were to one another. But yeah, it's so special to have been there as part of, you know, for that moment in Brett's life. And, you know, we talked, on It Made Air that we talked about going to Provincetown together. Mm-hmm. And a few weeks after I got home from 34, Brett and I went out to Provincetown to celebrate his birthday and, you know, had a time of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He was up at our Toronto event and then he was at the last New York event that we did. So much fun with the fans also.
Yes.
Like, really, like, has a really great spirit about everything.
Yeah. I mean, if you get a chance to hang out with Brett LaBelle, like, you know, fly across the country to hang out with that guy. He's amazing.
Yeah.
And he has his friend Larry, who I don't know if you've met Larry.
I have not.
Larry is another gay Boston cop who is also hilarious. Mm-hmm. And the two of them together is just a riot. I keep encouraging them to start a podcast and I want to lobby
please,
Brett to do a podcast.
Well, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that going around, Zeke.
Yeah.
Nobody needs to be encouraged for more podcasts.
That was a really special moment. And then the loved ones visit was a really special moment. In 33 for me, I had this incredible moment with my dad, who I'm not terribly close with, but we, you know, he said something like, you know, my dad didn't know what had happened, right? He didn't know what had been said, what had I had told people, and he came out there and cried and said he loved me and called me his hero and that sort of stuff. I never heard from him before.
Mm-hmm. And so your father didn't know what had happened in the game in Survivor 33,
right?
Okay.
Or you know, whether or not like my being trans was like a known quantity,
right?
It was one of, you know, a handful of like big life moments I would have on Survivor. And
because
if I could,
I would have never been able to tell that you had any sort of a strained relationship with your father, or you know, there was anything. I mean, he came out, and I thought it was like a really nice moment in the season.
Yeah, it was, and you know, Survivor brought my dad was sort of like the person who in my family who was involved with the Survivor stuff. You know, other people in the family weren't as excited about it, but my dad was always on board and was my big supporter. And it was sort of the first time we'd sort of done something together. And again, it was a great life moment, but as I would learn, you know, sometimes you don't want to have epic life moments on Survivor if you're trying to win $1 million, because it does affect you when you have, you know, I on this podcast you talk a lot about like managing the emotional highs and lows, and anytime you have a big emotional high, it's countered with an equally impactful emotional low. And that was hard for me, going from like seeing my dad for 5 minutes and having this moment with him, and then going back to camp and being with like Hannah and Dave, who, you know, this was, you know, the day after the Rocks tribal, and things were weird, and this thing had happened with my dad, and you're trying to manage it, you're trying to get your head back in the game, but you can't, you're not there, and you're there, and I think not just me, everyone is really thrown by the loved one's visit. Yeah. It affects how you are in the game.
Yeah, I think that you frame it in an interesting way. And I think that really that Survivor, when you take a look at it, it really is sort of like about the, you know, the agony and the ecstasy and sort of like completely depriving you of something and then overloading you with that thing in that, like, you have no food and then you're so full that you want to throw up, and then you have no loved ones, and then they're there, really, like, you're dealing with just like it's all or nothing at any given point.
Yeah.
And then also try not to be emotional.
Right, yeah. Like, but like, be emotional so that people know you're a human and you have emotions.
Right.
But like, don't be too unemotional. Right.
We don't like that.
Exactly. But I think it's all of these extremes which makes Survivor like the incredible like high that it is. You know, I think it's very telling that there are probably like 15 people out of 500 who would not give their right arm for another chance on the beaches, you know? And
you're one of those 15?
I am one of those 15. Yeah. Well, I'll never say never, but I feel like I got, you know, I played the Magnum version and I, yeah, well, we can get to that later.
Magnum version.
Well, right. I mean, you have the regular size version, okay. And the longer, girthier version.
There's a lot of different interpretations. I wasn't sure if you were talking about like Tom Selleck or what.
Yeah.
Got it. You do have a Tom Selleck like mustache.
I do. And chest hair. And
yeah.
I think choice in Hawaiian shirts.
Yes. You could just say a green monster.
Green monster. Yes. Great. Yes. A Troyzan sized version of Survivor. How about that?
Got it.
We all know what that means. Yeah. So even though it's the hardest thing you've ever done, and you starve and you're go through these highs and lows, like you would always do it again. Which is why, you know, when I got voted out, which is such a surreal experience, you know, because you go into autopilot, you're like, I got to get my torch. I got to get my stuff. I got to go to Jeff. And then Jeff looks you dead in the eyes when he snaps your torch. You know, and I remember looking him dead in the eyes, watching the snuffer come over and extinguish my torch and being like, okay. And then you're told you have to walk away, but you just walk into the darkness. And then eventually, like, you know, someone has a flashlight and you see where to go. But for a while, you just walk into the darkness, not knowing where to go. And, you know, for me, you know, I was like, okay, I'm really proud. If this is my turn on Survivor, I'm really proud of my 33 days. Like, good job, buddy. And then, you know, that lasted for about 20 minutes because after I finished my, like, last words to camera, I look over my right shoulder and it's Probst.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, come with me, buddy. And we walk away from all the other crew. We're still in the shadow of tribal council. The fires are still burning. And he folds his arms and he looks me dead in the eyes again and says, so we've got a returning player season coming up. Would you want to come back and play in 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, my gut reaction was no. Like, because I feel like that is the philosophy of this podcast is don't do it. If you're getting asked back that quickly, you're going to get an ass back again down the line.
Well, that I don't know.
You're not going to play better.
What I say is I always say it's hard to say no to it because you don't know what the future holds. You don't know if there's going to be somebody who is, you know, similar to you in some way and that they just find like a newer version of you, the new hotness. I think it's hard to say no to it, you know, if you have a choice, but I feel like that I've been, you know, it's hard to say no to it.
Well, I mean I obviously felt it was hard to say no to.
Yeah.
And didn't, but it was actually I think from Evolution of Strategy, you and Josh talked about it, and because I knew 34 was going to be returning players. I knew Andrew was in the casting process. I used to joke with the producers during 33 saying like, you're gonna ask me back for 34. And then it happened. And I remember, you know, that walk from where I gave my confessional to where Probst pulled me aside to, thinking like, holy ass, am I about to get asked back? Are you going to do this again? And it was one of like the coolest moments of my life, I have to say. And yeah, I told him I needed a burger and a margarita and like a night to think about it. And I think he wanted an answer then. It was a little like, oh, Zeke's being difficult again. But yeah, and then you actually, if you go back and watch my Ponderosa video from Millennials Gen X, the Ponderosa cameras are in my face about 30 seconds after Jeff asked me back, and I'm very excited. If you watch like the first minute of my 33 one and contrast that with the first minute of my 34 one, I think you can get a sense of my different emotional states at the end of the different seasons.
It's not the same.
Yeah, but then I had to go back to Ponderosa and I couldn't tell anybody.
Right.
And so it was like I really never left Survivor because I was still like, not only did I have to stay in game mode, I was like making big decisions and couldn't let the other people around me know what was going on in my mind. And yeah, like stayed up for two more days trying to figure out what the right answer was. And I felt like I wasn't going to play better. I didn't even feel like I knew what I did right or wrong in 33. Like I was just, I didn't know, but I was like, you can't say no. Like there's no, like maybe yes isn't the right answer, but no is certainly the wrong answer.
You should say no, but I don't think anybody can. I think that's like I think that it's easier to say no like when you have something going on and you know I give bad advice in terms of that. But in terms of like, you know, when they want you to come back, I mean, how do you say no to Jeff?
Right. You don't. I also think like for me, this was embarking on this adventure. I was seeking to change my life in a pretty radical way. Mm-hmm. And I...
Mission accomplished.
Right. Yes.
Nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, who... Right. But yeah, I felt like I also didn't want Survivor to stop.
Yeah.
I was not ready for it to be over, and that it didn't get, that it didn't have to be over. I was taking that ride as long as I could.
So the emotional wounds of 33, do they go away at the point where they ask you to come back and play 34? Is it almost like sort of like, okay, whatever. I'm thinking about the next game. Do you stop thinking about 33 at that point?
Yeah, I would say I checked out of 33 a little bit. I mean, I wanted to get a sense of what people's perceptions of me, what I needed to change, what needed to be adapted. But also that's really warped. You know, no one really has a sense of perspective of what has happened. I would say I was cool with everybody except for Hannah. I was really continued to be extremely mad at Hannah and would be continue to be mad at Hannah for several months. I mean, obviously our wounds have healed mm-hmm. well at this point,
yes.
But yeah, I think for me, I went into game mode. I never stopped being in game mode. I went home. The third person I texted when I got my phone back was Andrea to be like, are you going to go play? And she's like, yeah. And we started to figure stuff out. But what I wanted to do I had 2 weeks off between getting home and going back. And I locked myself in my apartment. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I craved sushi. So I craved fish and rice, which is like what you eat on Survivor. Yeah. And then I watched a ton of Survivor seasons because I had a sense of who I would be playing with. And I mean, everyone had a sense of who they would be playing with. And I went and like watched game tape on people and listened to their podcasts. And
did it help or no?
I don't think it helped.
Yeah.
No, I really don't think it did. I just also don't think I had enough time to process it.
Yeah.
And you know, the sense of you get from people from watching the show or listening to their podcasts is very different than the sense that everyone else has of each other because they've all met each other before. Mm-hmm. You know, there are these, you know, charity events or, you know, finale parties or whatever. People are in contact and they know each other as people in a way that I never got to know anybody, with the exception of, I guess, Andrea and Michaela. Even Michaela, I didn't know that well. Yeah, but it was a wild 2 weeks. I was an insane person. And then I got back on a plane and went back to Fiji. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, we're about a year out where I would be in pregame for 34 at this point a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, 34 happens. And, you know, I feel like I've talked about so much about 34. I feel like I've done more press than any other Survivor player has ever for the Survivor season. So if there's 34 stuff you want to talk about, let's talk about it. But I don't have anything on my agenda.
Okay. Well, just in terms of the stuff from the, you know, starting out this game, I mean, I feel like that there's a lot of stuff from the early days of Nuku. And I feel like that, you know, we didn't see a ton of what you were doing in the beginning of that season. You know, you're getting out there, you're with this tribe in season 34. Are you like, do you feel like that you're in a good spot?
I feel like there was... Walking into the game, there was, I think I called it the ghost of Russell Hance in my pregame press. And there was definitely, that was there. And I felt it was important to give everybody like a reason for me to be there, like a character type that was not, you are this evil villainous mastermind, which I'm not. And so what I looked around and I was like, well, I was going to like lean into being the gay guy, but I'm the third gay guy. So that doesn't work. And it actually sort of counts against me. But no one else here is like a big Survivor nerd. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to like lean hardcore into being the Survivor nerd and sort of geek out at people. I'm not going to go look for idols. I'm going to stay around camp and just be excited to talk to everybody. And I think maybe in the first like 3 or 4 hours, like I was a target. But after that, I don't think I ever was in any trouble at Nuku. I think I deflected that very well early on. And, you know, people were not super keen to talk to me as they weren't most of the game. But Suri was, right? Because Suri was also sort of in trouble. And that, like, my first sort of alliance was with Suri. And that was pretty cool. Suri and I were cuddle buddies most of the season, all but the one tribe that we were on. Oh, and there was one night after Ozzy went home, the night where Andrea and Suri yelled at me, that I slept, like, by myself in the corner of the tarp. Yeah. My own little petty party. But yeah, so it was, that was really cool. I mean, Suri is, you know, one of my favorite players and is awesome. But yeah, the early days of Nuku were great. JT built us an amazing shelter. We had so much firewood. You know, Debbie and Brad told us insane, and JT told us insane stories all the time. And I...
Like what? Like about real life or about like their...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I mean, Brad can... I mean, Brad never shuts up. I mean, the reason I knew 34 was going to be different is like the moment we got to Ponderosa in pregame. And so, you know, you don't talk to each other. And in 33, when they called lockdown, which is what they say when you're not supposed to talk, nobody talked. Yeah, we just, we followed the rules.
The new players listen, and then it's a little bit like, you know, the senioritis kicks in on the returning player season's like, oh yeah, what are you going to do to us? You're going to send us home? Like, yeah, right.
Right, yeah. And I remember, we got to Ponderosa, and I sat at a table, and I opened up my book. I was reading Lonesome Dove, which is a great book. I recommend reading it. Mm-hmm. And Brad Culpepper slaps it out of my hand and says, this is my favorite book. You know what part I like? Just like wants to strike up a conversation about this book I'm reading. And I'm like, I don't know what to say. Like, I'm like, because you have to engage, right? Like, it would be poor, you know, strategy not to talk to him. But you're also like, we're supposed to follow the rules. And I follow the rules. But it was different. Yeah, JT has all of these insane stories about, like, you know, bar fights he's been in and, you know, Billy Goats he's had to wrangle. And, you know, Debbie has, I mean, we all know Debbie has a million amazing stories. And yeah, Brad just wants to give you his opinion about everything, which is generally like intelligent and entertaining. I enjoyed being out there with Brad. But it was very, yeah, I just felt like my job was sort of to sit on my hands and not like get any flat, like any dust on me.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I don't like just to sit around, but that was what was needed. And then we swapped, and I ended up being with the people I was closest with, Ozzy, Suri, Andrea, and Sarah. You know, I think people like, you know, are a little queasy about, you know, have some questions about, you know, some of the Suri stuff. But when we were at Tavua, the word started getting back to me that Suri didn't trust me anymore. Mm-hmm. And it, out of nowhere, I didn't know where it came from. I was like, this is weird. I think it was, I mean, I think we've all know how masterful a player Sarah is now. And those little whispers were coming from Sarah. And I think it was to pull me away. And it was very effective in creating mistrust between me and Suri.
Yeah.
And Sarah being able to maneuver me wherever she wanted to maneuver me. Because, you know, Sarah's, you know, one of the greatest of all time. But yeah, you know, my early game was really boring because I never went to tribal council. I was always in a good position.
Were you getting antsy?
Yeah, to play. I was. Particularly because you wonder how much gas you have in the tank.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think I ever had any ideations about making it to the end of Game Changers, even before everything went down. But that I wanted to... I think, you know, I as like, you know, the kid who wants to like, you know, be a pleaser of others, wanted to make sure that Jeff felt he brought me back because I was going to contribute to a good season. You know, I was going to live up to that like game changer, you know, title on my buff and play hard and play fast. And also, I would say that was how everyone on Millennials Gen X played. Like, Millennials Gen X was a bad primer for playing 34 because 33, everybody wanted to play hard and make moves and, you know, everyone was running around having a million conversations. You were never begrudged for having like going and talking to someone. Mm-hmm. And since everyone was talking to everyone at all the time, you could hide. It didn't like you could hide who you were really having like an important conversation with because everyone was just running around all the time. And on 34, we just sat our butts in the dirt all day long. It was so slow and so boring. I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
Throughout the entire game. And then I just sort of like went into hyperdrive.
So what do you chalk that up to? Is that just sort of like the, bringing back some of these like older school? I don't know if the older school, like there's you know, not too many people that are really old school that are on the season. But do you feel like is it mostly the older players that are like who are the people that in 34 that are really policing? Oh, that, you know. Like, that person's talking, and trying to really just, like, if this was a football game, sort of just, like, run out the clock.
Well, I would say if we're, I think the football analogy is, yeah. You know, Brad and Sierra were really, I think, setting the tone. And I think, you know, the tone was sort of set on tribes that I was not on. I mean, you look at, you know, with the exception of Caleb, who the first five, you know, six people go out are, and that's, I think you could say, sort of, like, the best players in the game, right? The people who came in with the best resumes or maybe, you know, embodied that title of game changer most. And, you know, the what you hear...
And Beast Mode Cowboy.
Right. Yes. Who, you know... Right. Yes. He's sort of the asterisk on that, you know, those six.
One of the greatest Big Brother players, though.
Oh, right. Definitely.
Yes.
Tons of... I watched that season of Big Brother. Yeah. So... I think everyone, the word that you get, you know, we were just getting information from Troy Zane about what happened on Mana, and the story we told is the people who are playing, the people who are having conversations, the people who are trying to make this a, you know, an interesting season, they're getting voted out, and that has an effect on you. You're like, well, we gotta, right? Like, one of, I think, the true tenets of Survivor is you have to play the pace of the game, and the pace has been dictated by other people, and we were just all following it at this point. And yeah, that was sort of frustrating for me, especially because like my most like, you know, I came off this like, you know, the Chris Blindside and the Rock draw and everyone's flipping and they're, you know, and I was like, this is why Survivor is fun. Like Survivor is fun to play. Like it's fun when stuff is going down. Like it's fun when alliances are shifting and, you know, like at least for me, cause I get bored. Like my mind wanted to be active. Cause if you're thinking about the game, you're also not thinking about how miserable you are. You're not like building, you know, monster ice cream sundaes in your brain all the time. You have something else to think about and to do. And I love Survivor and I wanted to play and I was not enjoying the like, sitting around moping all the time. But yeah, that, you know, and then there was some like fun gameplay that happened, you know, after I got voted out, which is great. But yeah, it was not exactly my speed. I was definitely not having the blast even before the blast that I had in 33.
Your relationship with Andrea must have been so bizarre to be in this All-Star season and have somebody that you were good friends with in real life. That
well, I would say we knew each other. Okay, I don't know that we were good friends.
Okay, you were, but you had this friendship that nobody else knew about.
Right.
Where I feel like that this is kind of rare to have happen on Survivor. I feel like if anything, you know, we might have like, it's more of like a Big Brother twist of like these people know each other from the outside.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, we had brunch before we went out and I think we were both sort of thought we would not start together.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I remember the moment we were on the pirate ship and they were handing out buffs and like she got a blue buff and I got a blue buff at the same time and we locked eyes and we're like, okay, we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And even when, because we didn't know who knew that we knew each other. So we didn't know if, like, the producers knew if we knew each other.
Okay.
Because actually, Matt Pavlovich tried to post Survivor Brooklyn during the Koh Rong finale, which was the 2 weeks that I was home. And it was up for about an hour. And I had to get on the phone with him and say, you have to take this down.
Nope.
Yeah. And I just, I was like, okay, so Matt. So, like, I was on 33 and about to go back for 34. And Andrew's on 34. And, like, people can't know that we know each other because it's going to. Yeah. So I had to, like, spill the beans to him. And he did take it. He was not happy about it, but he did take it down. I think until we left.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, because so we didn't know who knew that we had this connection. So even when we weren't around other people, we were really skittish about bringing it up. And sort of even when we were alone, pretending that we didn't know each other. But it did come out like the night that Andrea and I, you know, had our first big explosion. Andrea did, you know, yell this out to everybody that we did reveal that we knew each other before. So people did make sense of that eventually, especially when we started fighting over our friends.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yes.
Who was going to take who in
yes.
the divorce.
Aubrey brought that up on her podcast.
Yes.
At Nuku, did you have a target in mind or you were just going with the flow?
Well, Ceree was the target. Debbie's name was getting thrown around, but I found there was often like a politically correct name, like the name that you could always throw out. Like Ty was often that name, but that person wasn't in any actual danger. So Ceree was the one with the target and I was not excited about that because I was obviously close with Ceree. I would have much preferred Debbie to go home, I think, at that time. But I really wasn't in a position to be making any decisions. I was just trying to make sure I was not the name.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then ultimately, you guys end up going to this swap tribe at this point.
Right.
You have that...
Actually, interesting fact. On Millennials Gen X, I was on the same beach for 33 days.
Yeah.
It was the Millennial Beach, which became the Vanua Beach, which was our merge beach. And then we swapped to Tavua, and Tavua is the millennial beach.
Okay.
So, and I was there for 7 days. So I spent 40 days of my survivor career on one beach.
Were you excited to be like, I'm back, baby?
I was. Well, because there's also like, I kept running, there was all this like debris from like, you know, a basket or something or another from the millennial camp. And also we weren't at the millennial camp. We were a little bit down the path where our millennial water well was. They cleared that area out for the Tavua camp. But like you would walk back and there was the graveyard of the millennial camp. Like our shelter had been taken away. Our fire pit had been filled in with sand, but you're like, it was like, you know, imagine like visiting like a battle site where you like fought like a battle in a war.
Did you just go there by yourself or you took anybody there?
Like, I would take people there, but I would sometimes wander back there at night. I would like wake up and need to pee and like out of instinct would walk like pretty far to my like where my pee spot was, like past the millennial camp. Oh, also I made this like dumb fake idol in the early days of 33, and Ozzy and I were hunting for the real idol, and Ozzy goes, dude, I found something. And I was like, oh, okay. And I look over and it's the bush I stashed my fake idol in, and Ozzy found my fake idol I made in 33.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, it was. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah.
That was a fun little coincidence.
Did they say like this is from a previous Survivor game?
Oh no. Well, I mean, it wasn't even. It was more. When I felt I was in trouble, I thought I needed something to have the appearance of an idol. So all it was a piece of canvas tied over like a bunch of dried leaves.
Yeah.
So even if you open it up, it wouldn't be a fake idol.
Ozzy
it was just the like,
this is no fake idol.
It was more
idol.
The like, remember in Rupert and Heroes Villains put a rock in his pocket?
Yeah.
That's more it. But I would say, you know, look, there are so many like incredible parts about Survivor that I think if fans got a chance to see, they would be really impressed by. Like the camera guys who shoot you, there's one camera on any like, you know, conversation that you might have. And with one camera, they shoot it like they're shooting a whole film. Like they'll shoot like over the shoulders and they'll step back for the wide and look at the low angle and the high angle. And they just sense the beats in conversations and can maneuver around. Like they know when a conversation is going to get dull and they can stop and reset and like get a shot of someone's hand or when they like need to be in someone's face and when they need to catch the reaction. Like one of like the things that I would love to do would be to go and like party with all the crew because they were there for everything that happened to me. They were there for this like insane 90 days of my life and saw everything and were like, you laughed with me and cried with me, but I still don't know many of their names. And like, I just want to buy all these guys like a round of beers and like, cause it's weird that, you know, you get to celebrate it with your castmates, but they're only part of the people who were with you on this adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And the other people are just, they're incredible in their own right. Yeah. And I think that's sort of one of the biggest takeaways I took from Survivor is that people who listen to this podcast, including the people who make Survivor who do listen to this podcast, everyone loves Survivor so much. And it's that passion which makes Survivor so good and which makes it, you know, last for 34 seasons or 36 seasons, I think we can say, in 18 years. And that was a really special part for me, was to see Survivor in its entirety and see that like the love that I have for Survivor pervades everyone who is a part of it.
What did you tell people in Survivor 34 about how you did in Survivor 33?
I said I went out ninth. I made it 33 days. People were like, well, why are you a game changer? Mm-hmm. And I talked about,
like, why are you a game changer?
Yeah. I was like, well, like I had this, like I was on the bottom with the millennials and then we swapped. And I had this relationship with this guy, Chris, who's from Oklahoma. And then we were moving along and I heard that Chris was going to come after me. And so I managed to like turn on Chris before he turned on me. And then I sort of made this big move and got voted out.
Mm-hmm.
Did not talk about rocks.
Yeah.
I left that out. Though, you know, Michaela informed everyone of the rocks situation, I believe.
Yeah. Where'd she get all her intel from?
Hannah, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Hannah was sort of, that's where she got. I actually called Michaela in our time off and was like, because I knew Michaela wasn't a fan. And I was like, Michaela, you got to understand the thing about returning player seasons. Like, they're going to be pregame alliances. And like, you know, I sort of knew who was going to be there. And I was like, we got to talk about who's going to be there. And I was going to give her like dossiers on everybody. But I called her and maybe I was just a little like too excited. But I was like, all right, Michaela, we got to talk. And Michaela just wasn't interested in hearing any of it. Like, I was like going to like give her this whole download, but she was just sort of like, Yeah, all right, Zeke. And, you know, we talked for about 5 minutes, and it was super awkward, and I did not feel good about my relationship with Michaela going into the game.
Slide to the side. Slide to the side.
Yeah. But it was so interesting when ultimately you went out and she was so upset. Was that all from stuff that happened like during 34?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we were friendly with each other on 33. We were buds. But we, you know, Michaela and I went to tribal council together 5 times. Mm-hmm. 4 of those times we voted differently than each other. 3 of those times she voted for me. Mm-hmm. So in the game, we were really never on the same page. But you know, it's a really insane thing to, I talked about this in my exit press with you, you know, to leave home for 4 months and not know what your job situation is going to be when you get home, or knowing that you have changed or your life's about to really radically change, mm-hmm. you know, having all this stuff. And the only person who could understand that specific experience was Michaela. And I think
so she looked at you the way you look at the camera people. She's like, you know, there was this guy, he was around for both of the times that I played.
Right.
He was here. One day I'd like to, you know, have a beer with him.
Yeah. And I think you also saw Michaela was pretty socially ostracized, right? Like, and I, you know, was, I think, one of the couple people who, I always wanted to work with Michaela, so I always wanted her to know that I was her friend, whether or not we were voting together. And I think that's what you see her, you mm-hmm. know, crying, was like the one person who sort of understands how in chaos my life is right now just left me.
Yeah. I don't want to like pick through the bones of the whole incident with Varner and everything. You've talked about that so much, but is there anything from that you feel like that you feel like you haven't been able to talk about, or that people have a misconception about?
Gosh, I don't know. I've talked and written it to death. If people haven't been so inundated with everything, I would recommend you reading my piece in The Hollywood Reporter. I actually wrote 2 pieces. Mm-hmm. You can find that on my Twitter. It's my pinned tweet. Another big shout out to Josh Wigler, who yeah. sort of, you know, is the reason why that was able to happen. And yeah, I don't know. I would say my takeaway is that, you know, something sort of dark happened, but that everyone responded in the best, most admirable way mm. possible, you know, from like everyone on my tribe in the moment and Jeff in that moment, and then Survivor and CBS going forward. You know, I feel like I am really privileged to have had such a deep look at the people who make Survivor and how Survivor is made. Mm-hmm. And I think really to take a look at Probst too, who I just have the deepest respect for him. I'm really in awe of him as a person. You know, he is the showrunner. Mark Burnett's not really involved with Survivor. Survivor like begins and ends with Probst. And he, like, his job as executive producer is to oversee the health and well-being of 400, you know, crew members in a remote foreign land, and then direct this epic, you know, multi-million dollar show on CBS and be responsible for that, and then also be so present as like the incredible, like, you know, 4-time Emmy winning host that he is, being out there on the beaches with us conducting tribal council. Oh, and then also he will also be like editing, you know, when he was on 35, he was like, you know, editing 34 and casting 36. And, you know, it's all the amount of stuff that guy does and executes at such a high level is just so impressive. Mm-hmm. And he is, you know, I don't know that Jeff Probst knows a lot about trans people. Like, this is not his cause du jour. I just sort of showed up at his door and this thing happened. And he has always been by my side and had my back and advocated for me to be able to speak on my own terms and do press and write things. And, you know, I just can't speak highly enough about him and how, you know, he has not just approached my story after, you know, everything went down, but I don't think there's any other reality show that allows a trans person to go on and not have that be their story mm-hmm. and not have that be sort of like the essential thing about them as a character. I think that's special to Survivor, and I think it speaks to how well made and how, you know, the people care about the integrity of the storytelling of this great adventure. I got a gush on everyone.
Because at the time that it happened, that in the days that followed, I do feel like that there was a lot of criticism of that, hey, you know, they didn't have to show this, that they could have gone, you know, a different direction with this. And, you know, my response to it was always like that, you know, if you were okay with it, I don't know why other people should have a problem with it being part of the show.
Right. Yeah. And I've been very passionate on the record in my defense of airing it. And it's interesting. I don't think it ever crossed anyone's mind, including mine. And I've sort of always been like the leader. They've always followed my lead. And the first time we had a conversation about it, the conversation was never started from a place of should it air, but the conversation was, how do we do this right? That was always what I was invested in. Mm-hmm. That was always what Jeff and Matt and everyone else was invested in. And I think because my starting place in the conversation was, we have this, we're doing it, let's do it great. That's just where everybody else took off from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you have any thoughts as this was going on and you know, you knew this was coming, it aired on the show, and then I know that it was surprising to me to see how big of a international story that this became, where it sort of was featured on all of the major networks, nightly news and CNN and you know, all
33
of these
articles in the New York Times.
Right. I mean, and of course, you know, you handled everything with such poise, but just to be at the center of this firestorm. I mean, you were a guy that just was like, you know, hey, it's my dream to go beyond Survivor, and then to have, you know, a lot of good ends up, you know, coming out of this also. But just what is that like to get sucked into this whole other world?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was 9 months in waiting for it to happen and preparing, and no one from, you know, Nick Adams and the team at GLAAD that I worked with to, I think, Survivor and CBS, no one thought it would be as big as it was, that it would have the legs that it did. And I think B thought the reaction would be so overwhelmingly positive. Mm-hmm. Like, we were, you know, having conversations with CBS security about, you know, what's the procedure for reporting threats. And, you know, I was worried. There was just no one knew. And it's so funny because I was in LA for it, and I watched it with a couple of friends. I watched the East Coast feed. Aubrey's boyfriend actually had it on CBS All Access on his laptop, and then through Google Hangouts streamed it through his phone to my iPad, which we watched in the hotel.
Dan, what a great job.
Yeah, Dan's a great guy.
Yeah.
I know Aubrey is...
He was here the other day.
Oh, yeah, he's fun. I know Aubrey's notoriously dates, you know, all of these, Cochran and whoever else. But, you know, really, Dan's the guy, and he's the man.
Guy.
Dan the man. Yeah, so we, you know, watched, and then that night everything was positive, and then the next day I woke up and was on the talk. Got to meet Julie Chen. Totally fanboyed out over Julie Chen.
Yeah.
She was great. She took a picture with me, It was great. Yeah. So, you know, did the talk, which I was so nervous. And that's when we saw the headlines coming in of should they have aired it. And I was just like, I got to defend my team. I got to have the backs of the people who have had my back throughout this. And I got a chance to address that on the talk. And then after the talk, it was like, well, okay. And Hannah was here doing the podcast, and I was staying with her. So I actually didn't have a place in LA to go. So I ended up going to Adam Klein's grandmother's house.
Okay.
And I watched most of the fallout with Adam Klein's grandmother.
When you say, so you were on the internet, with Adam Klein's grandmother?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't watching a ton of it. My friend Katie, who I was with, I had this whole team with me, including Adam and his lovely girlfriend, Juliana.
Yes.
And we were just sitting around at Adam Klein's grandmother's living room, sipping margaritas in the middle of the day, just watching all of these articles come in and sorting through the Twitter response and watching Probst talk to Katie Couric. And yeah, I think that's the funny thing is I was international news, but I was also sort of a man without a country. I didn't have a place to be. Yeah, I still don't think I've made sense of how big it was or everything that's happened or what it means for me or what it means for the cause, I suppose. It's just so big and so wild. And I'm typically pretty articulate, but I'm still a little speechless about everything that happened. I just feel so grateful and so lucky.
And overall, the media coverage, did you feel that it was...
Top notch.
Great.
You know, I think even a lot of places went out of their way to not even call me the trans survivor player, and they called me like the survivor player who was outed as trans, like going out of the way and using like the bulkier language. And I think we, you know, I think there's a lot of hesitation or a lot of anxiety about, you know, what was going to be said about the trans survivor player on a season called Game Changers. And Hannah and I spent a lot of time like making jokes about all of those potential permutations or puns on Game Changers, but none of those came out. None of those made headlines.
I think you probably like you shouldn't even put that out in there in the ether.
Well, and at this point, I think, you know, who cares, right? Yeah. But it's actually, I will say this. So I'm not a person who has looked a ton at the Survivor fan sites, or I'd given away all of my social media. My social media was being managed by my best friend Katie at this point, so I wasn't really looking at any of this. But I. As a note to future players, and I think former players as well, as to why you shouldn't look at this stuff, you know, as the world was having such a positive, beautiful reaction, I was getting tons of love and support and millions of messages and emails and everything was great. It's like, you know, I think kind of like a monumental shift in how a trans person was received in the public light. And a couple of days later, I got all these text messages from Hannah and Adam who were like, I'm so sorry, everything's so horrible and everyone's being awful. Like, no, you're great. And I was like, what is going on?
Right.
But like the 2% of negative response I got was all on the Survivor subreddit and like the Survivor fan Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they were looking at, to the exclusion of everything else, which was so positive.
That's interesting, where, you know, we're so much in our own bubble. And I do feel like that a lot of the coverage, like inside of Survivor turned, you know, this was like, you know, an issue with one survivor did something to another survivor. And I do feel like that there was a push to, you know, well, who are you supporting in this, and not necessarily where, like outside of Survivor, where, you know, one survivor is interchangeable with another,
right?
Then it was much more of the big picture view. That's interesting.
Yeah. And I think that the fans and say podcast and everyone has sort of like, because what happened was so beyond Survivor, right? It had nothing to do with what everything else was happening. And it's sort of, how do you like weave it back in and reconcile, you know, talking about the game and strategy and whatever else. And it's been, I think, I think everyone's done a good job, but I think there has been some like complicated finessing of how do you make sense of this with the rest of the season. It happened.
So if you were going to have this come out on the show on your terms, was that something that you had ever thought about, of what that would have looked like if you were going to, or it was just going to be something that if you ever decided that was going to be it, but it wasn't something that was sort of like forethought was given?
Well, it's actually interesting. I've never talked about this before on the record, at least. And I remember that whole day that it happened very clearly, because I woke up euphoric. It was a beautiful day in Fiji. Like, I mean, every day is beautiful in Fiji, but it was a particularly beautiful day. And I woke, like, typically most days you wake up on Survivor and you expect to wake up, like, I expected to wake up, you know, in my soft bed in my apartment in Brooklyn. And then you wake up and there's a boom in your face and you're in the dirt and you're like, oh, right, I'm on Survivor. And you have to, like, adjust to that reality. But that day I woke up and I expected to wake up on Survivor. I was just, like, out of my mind happy. We'd run one pizza the day before, so like we had coffee from the coffee reward, so I had like pizza and coffee for breakfast. We were on the way to the challenge, and I remember thinking, you're gonna merge tomorrow. We knew, I mean, we had enough of a sense of that, which means you're about to make the merge in your all-star season. Like, dude, like, you expected to get voted out third. Like, you used to be this like shy guy who, you know, and look at you, like, you're wearing a Survivor Game Changer buff. You're an all-star. Like, you're about to make the merge. Like, dude, like, what could you possibly be afraid of?
Yeah.
I think this is just like a personal moment of like being like, what do you have to be afraid of in life? What do you need to prove to what more do you need to prove to yourself?
Yeah.
And thinking that after the merge, it wasn't going to be anytime soon, but like after the merge, it would be worth like being like, well, hey, you know, there's, you know, I'm reflecting on my Survivor experience, and there's this other part of me that, like, I haven't talked about, but, like, yeah, I think, like, I never wanted to talk to the other players about it. I never, if I made it to the end, I was never going to bring it up at the end, but I thought, like, in a confessional, like, having this sort of be, like, a note of my story would have been nice. So that's how I would have done it ideally, and was sort of, I think, starting to lay the groundwork for that to happen.
You would have told people during the game?
No. To lay the groundwork to talk about it in an interview.
Okay. After the game. Or to the viewers, a vote or two
into the merge, be like, oh, yeah, there's this too.
Okay, so you were going to, you know, maybe have it be part of your story to the people at home,
right? But not part of the game. I felt like if it was ever part of the game, it was going to have a negative impact. Not because people would have a problem with it,
yeah,
but because anyone who has a compelling story, it would, you know, that would be, I think, challenging to make it to the end. And that's sort of also, I think, part of like my philosophy was like, I didn't come to be the trans survivor player. I came to be a survivor player, and I want to be rewarded as a survivor player, not because I have a story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a point of personal pride.
Yeah. So after this all ends up being, you know, this event, and, you know, this was sort of like this, you know, huge like cultural moment also that happens on the show, the story starts to shift to become like, oh, well, it's not that we have to get rid of Zeke because, you know, that he's been hiding something. We have to get rid of Zeke because he has the best story. In the real time of that, again, it was like a little bit of a shift for, you know, us as viewers to sort of like process like, oh, that's how this is going to be interpreted. When did you realize that that was how it was going to be interpreted by the players? It was instant?
Yeah, I felt, because I even remember being at the tribal that it happened, and I think one of the reasons I sort of, I think, respond in the way that I do respond is that even though this insane moment happened and I knew my life was forever going to be different, I didn't ever stop understanding that I was playing Survivor in the midst of a game for $1 million. And I think a lot of the reason why I stay calm is that in the back of my mind, I'm saying, if you cry and make a big deal out of this, it's really going to hurt you down the line. And the cooler you can be and the more you can just brush this off like this isn't a big deal and like this isn't going to like turn your world upside down, the better it's going to be for you in the long term. And that, I mean, as silly as it is, like winning Survivor was still on my mind in the midst of that moment happening, and I think guided me to reacting well.
Mm-hmm.
As insane as that sounds, but I think it speaks to how intoxicating Survivor is. You are immersed in this world. You have no other reality. The only thing you are focused on or care about is playing the game. Well, I mean, that changed for me afterwards when I couldn't help but like think about home. I after it happened, I really was never as engaged in the game as I would have otherwise been. But yeah, I felt like even going back to camp that night that like, damn, my shot's over. But I think, you know, the next day we merged, which thank God we merged. Well, I mean, it was a terrible time to merge. Like, you want to be at your best at the merge, and I certainly was not fully engaged in the game. But I'm glad we merged the next day because there was rum at the merge feast, okay. And I got good and drunk.
There was a scenery shift.
Yes.
Yes. So a mental and a physical one.
Right. I was very, you know, I glad that I, me, Ozzy, and Andrea, all three of us, we had a fun afternoon,
yeah.
Which was necessary. But yeah, and then I remember the next day, I felt this like, you know, shift in the energy that people who I felt like I had good relationships with, like someone like Debbie, just not quite as interested in talking to me anymore. And then, you know, my name was the decoy vote.
Because she felt like you were a threat now.
Right.
Yeah.
And my name was my name was immediately the decoy vote.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, guys, I'm starting to I'm having a really tough time and I'm the decoy vote. Like, really? Mm-hmm. Like, there are so many people who could be the decoy vote. And why does it have to? But I thought, like, that's how expendable I was at that point. And, you know, honestly, I think it's like anything on Survivor. If you can weather the immediate bump, like, you know, how Adam weathers him and Taylor stealing the food. Not that Adam stole food. Adam didn't steal food. Adam didn't eat any of the food.
Right.
Taylor stole food and Adam witnessed it. But Adam did take some flack for that. And Adam was in trouble. But Adam just sort of chilled out and weathered it and, you know, obviously was able to win. I think if I could have done that, that it wasn't as doomsday maybe as I felt it was at the time, but my ability to manage that emotionally did not exist.
Yeah.
Right. I was grappling with all those highs and lows and they were happening so fast and so frequent. And I was really important to me that I seemed that I was okay, that I like didn't cry or,
mm-hmm.
right. But I just, you know, I just, There were 11 days I played after I was outed, and those were 11 very difficult days for me as a human being.
Yeah. And so the initial merge starts to happen, and you guys end up voting out Haley.
Right.
And then there is the swing to vote out Ozzy, which you're blindsided by at that point. But there's also everything that's going on, right? Do I have that right? Where then this is the point where you're trying to talk to Sierra, where you're talking about making a move against Andrea, and then they're talking about making a move against you, and in that, or is that one vote later?
No, Ozzy votes the second vote. And I said this in Exit Press, and I don't think people appreciated it as much at the time as they do now. But that Sarah was the one who was like, "Hey, let's go. We don't trust Andrea and Suri. Let's go work with Brad and Sierra." And obviously that worked out for Sarah, because Sarah votes with them and then has their trust. I think it speaks to sort of what my position was in the game at that point, that, you know, I was giving people intelligence about the other side, and they would go and repeat that to people that they knew. Like, Sierra knows that Andrea and Suri are her adversaries, and I'm coming to report intelligence about her adversaries. And people are so unwilling to play with me that she goes and reports intelligence to her adversaries about me.
Do you wish, if you had that time in the game to do over again, that you would have just tried to lay low more? Because you talk about riding out the storm and weathering the storm, but I feel like that, you know, you're also like in fight or flight mode at that point in the game after everything that's happened, that it seems like that your like instinct is to sort of, you know, scramble and play hard.
Exactly. Well, I think, you know, I say that I had the option of chilling out, but I also knew that chilling out doesn't change the reason why people want to vote me out. Right? Staying calm doesn't make me less of a target, right? Because it's not my gameplay at that point that's making me a target. And I felt that I hadn't got really a chance to play Survivor in the way that I like to play Survivor. And that, like, gosh darn it, if I can't win, I want to go play. I want to run around and do something. Because also, if I'm not running around and playing and having conversations, I'm just sitting around being hungry and thinking about all the million ways in which my life is going to be different when I go home.
And on that note, do you feel like that, okay, now I've sort of been outed as a trans person, and now that people are looking at me as I am now a representative of, you know, all trans people, and so if I play a certain way, that's going to be some reflection on other people who aren't even in the game?
Right. Yes. That was one of like the million weights I felt on my shoulder. Was like, you have to. I felt it was important to not, if my MO from 33 was like, he plays big and recklessly and takes big swings, that it was important to continue to keep doing that, right? To show that I was unaffected, that this was not going to change who I was as a Survivor player. I felt a lot of things out there. I think that I did not have the Survivor experience that 2 years ago I would have told you that I wanted, right? I would have wanted, as we began this podcast, to be sort of lionized as the chosen one in this, like, you know, like the
prince who was promised.
Exactly, right? To, like, you know, be everything I think everybody thought I was going to be in my intro video at the beginning of Millennials Gen X, right? I would have loved to be that for you guys. I think I would have loved for all my moves to have worked out and to won $2 million and, you know, be Tony and Cochran and everyone great rolled into one. But I think I walked into the game thinking I'm going to go play this great strategic game and really did not appreciate the profound, like, personal experience that it was going to be. And, you know, I think no one is more disappointed in how I ended up as a strategic player than me. Right. Like, I think no one feels that weight more than I do, though people love to remind me of it. But I think what I got from Survivor was so much more. And I think I wouldn't change my Survivor experience, you know, as it's been really, really difficult in a lot of moments. You know, I would say that not even that time that I spent on the beach, but, like, you know, the past 10 months have been very, very difficult. What kind of Survivor has given me an appreciation of is that, like, if you're able to withstand the immediate sting of pain, right, the immediate like ow of pain, and get past that and sort of live with it, that's what makes you grow and makes you better as a person. Mm-hmm. You know, I, as a human, am so much happier and am so much more excited about the future. And I think at ease with myself because I've been through this bananas year and a half, and that I've endured everything that I have, and I've been forced to grow and adapt and change. I wish I could have a better, you know, reputation as a strategist, but I wouldn't change anything that happened.
Yeah. Hey, who cares?
Yeah. I'm like, you know, it's all good.
Yeah. You didn't have the experience that you wanted, but you had the experience you needed.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, it's a very Probstian way of putting it.
Yes, I think he probably says that. Yeah, he says, you know, this is something that he says, yada yada yada, adventure or something.
Well, you get the adventure you're prepared for.
Okay,
it's something along those lines.
When you went and played the first time, when you were like the guy showing up on the beach and the first day. I mean, did you have any sense of like, you know, I feel like something is missing? Like, did you feel like that there was any sort of like I'm really hoping to get an experience, or did you feel like, hey, everything is fine, I'm here to, you know, play,
I just wanted to have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to go out there and have a blast. I think for me, I always wanted to play in a way that would get me ass back. Right. That was always on my mind. Was like, you're probably not gonna win, but like, you want to be an all-star. You want to get a ticket back, and you know what is necessary in order to get invited back, and that is to contribute something to the season. I just wanted to enjoy it. Like, I thought that was how I was going to be at my best and find the most from Survivor, was just to go and have a blast. And I did, at least in Millennials Gen X.
Do you think that if you ever did play Survivor again, and not in the immediate future, I mean, do you think that you would be able to take any of this sort of like, yeah, I like whatever happens, happens, let me just have fun? Or do you feel like that, you know, when it is fun is when you're really wheeling and dealing?
Well, I guess that's the question. If if I played again, which I don't think I won't say never, but I don't think I'll ever play again. I think I would potentially be asked, but I think I would say no. I definitely would say no right now. I don't know that I make it past a first vote. And if I do, I think the way I have to play is just like sit on my butt at camp and just chill and not like, right? Because my MO now is that like I turn on my closest allies, and I love to make big moves, and I'm a bit of a showman, right? Like, I like to make a splash, and I don't think any of those things endear you to other players, because everybody, especially on a returning player season, wants to make a splash and wants to, you know, be right, all that. And so I think the only way I could play, if I did play again, I just have to sit around, and I don't know, I don't like sitting around, I like to play. Right? Like, I would be just going to do it a third time, and there's nothing I want from Survivor, there's nothing I need from Survivor at this point. Like, I mean, aside from like, you know, a raucous party with the crew.
You're all about hanging out with the crew.
Well, I just...
You wanted to be a dream teamer. Yeah. Now you just want to go hang out with the crew.
That's what I keep saying, is that I imagine the alternate timeline where I am a segment producer on Survivor right now. And that, I think that would be a cool thing too.
Is that something that you would ever want to get into, of working in reality?
Oh, no. I think it'd be it's very specific to Survivor.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think reality as a whole, right? Because Survivor is such a unique, you know, landmark in the reality landscape. And I think, you know, as fans, like, we have this, like, there's so much negativity, and people, like, you know, complain all the time. And yeah, I get it, the themes are hokey, but like, who cares about the themes? We have this amazing game of strategy and adventure that I think we all are drawn to in a very passionate way. And it's so well made. Like, Survivor is awesome, and it's better than any other reality show out there.
Even
Glass House. Though, you know, Glass House never got to reach its full potential, I would say.
Yes.
Maybe it needs to be brought back.
Primetime 99.
Whatever happened to Primetime 99, Alex
Stein? Yeah, Primetime 99, he's going to come back and reinvent the way that Glass House is played.
Oh, great.
He's the first
Glass House game changer.
Beautiful.
I would say that it's really, there's no way that I can really communicate what this experience is, but I will say, so you spent 9 months podcasting about two seasons of Survivor, mm-hmm. right? And you have a new podcast every day and blogs and whatever. So that's enough experience to fill like 9 months of content for you. It happened to me in about 90 days,
mm-hmm.
right? It was a very, very intense summer for me. And, you know, you come home and none of your friends or your family has any idea what happened. There are all of these people who are tremendously important to your life. You know, people like Hannah and Brett and you know, Sarah and Andrea, and no one has any idea why these people matter to you. You have been off the grid for 4 months. You know, I also missed so much happened while I was gone. When I got on a plane in March to go, there's no way Trump was going to be the nominee. And I come home and Trump's going to be the nominee. And I think also one of the things that really shook me is I was gone for the Orlando shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home and found out about that like a month and a half after it had happened. And like, yeah, that I'd missed that and I'd missed being there for my community for that. That was a hard thing. But yeah, it felt like there was this epic shift in the country,
mm-hmm.
that there were just not just the Orlando shooting, but all sorts of shootings that summer. And none of that was like the country I felt like I left. Like I felt like the world had changed. And also there was this darkness over me now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an introvert, which doesn't mean I don't like being around people. It means that I recharge alone. And there's no alone time at any point on Survivor, even when you're on the jury. So I came home and like sat alone in my apartment for 3 weeks and like everyone was mad at me because I'd been gone for so long. And then I was still like hiding out. It took a long time to really be able to like function. And even when I went to the bar with my buddy Steve after an improv show, which is a thing I've done a million times. I've done an improv show and gone to the bar. Used to be the most comfortable thing I would ever do. And then I remember I was at the bar and our group had divided into two sections. There was like the front of the bar people and the back of the bar people. And I started doing Survivor math. I was counting numbers and I was like, am I in the numbers? And like, why are these people connected? And why are these people connected? Like, what are the relationships here? I couldn't go into a social situation without doing Survivor math.
Right.
And without like the fear that I was going to be voted out of like hanging out at a dive bar with a group of my closest friends.
What helped you get through that? Just time?
Time. Yeah, my social circle really narrowed. I used to kind of like keep a pretty wide net of people that I had in my life, and that really condensed down to like 10 of my closest friends that I could really, because I needed a lot from them. Like I typically was the guy who always gave and never needed anything. And it was finally a point in my life where I needed something from other people, which is hard for me.
Right.
And so I brought them close and you know, tried to surround myself with as much love as I could.
Now, you have a lot of friends that are not necessarily in the Survivor world, may not even be Survivor fans. And that sounds, just to have friends, I'm very jealous. But I mean, do they understand anything that you're going, especially when it's like you've played these two seasons, nothing is aired. Do they understand anything that's going on?
They know how different I am, mm-hmm. from the guy who left and the guy who came back.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what was an insane thing was that the outing happened on day 18. I get voted out on day 29. I don't get back to New York until what would be day 41.
Mm-hmm.
So between 18 and 41, it's almost 4 weeks. And so I hadn't been able to like tell a friend or a loved one, someone who was close to me, what had happened for almost 4 weeks, and get the, like, I think the love that I sort of needed after that.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't quite understand what had happened, but they knew something major had happened and that they needed to be there for me. And they were incredible. Like I don't know what I would have done without them. They were with me like day in and day out. Mm-hmm. That and the great therapist that CBS paid for me to see every week.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That's better than winning.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
It's expensive. So then once the Millennials versus Gen X started to come on, was there any sort of like healing in that where it's like, watching those home movies?
Yeah. Well, I tried to enjoy Millennials Gen X as much as I enjoyed playing it.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I knew I was like, for me, it was always like the fall is going to be the fun part. You're going to get to enjoy this with your friends. And we did, like, you know, it's no secret that the Millennials Gen X cast loves each other. We all came out like on like episode 4, we all came to LA and had like a mini reunion. And then, you know, after the reunion, we had so much fun in Vegas. Yeah. So I really did feel like I got to enjoy that and enjoy the airing of that season. I mean, it's, you deal with, you know, what it's like to get all these Twitter followers and people tweeting at you and, you know, seeing your name and the whatever, right? Like, yeah. That's a bit of an adjustment, but it was just fun. And then I remember being at the 33 finale when all the 33 stuff had wrapped up and Probst was like, and then we come back, we're going to show you what we're doing next. And I remember like just the sinking feeling on stage of being like, okay, here we go. It's time for 34.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there was always in the back of my head, you know, 34 is coming. And it wasn't just, you know, I was worried about all of 34, not just the big moment. But yeah, I mean, the airing, everything about 33 was fun.
Yeah. Can you tell us anything about Vegas?
Yeah. Adam paid for us all to have rooms at Caesar's Palace.
Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't have to have a buddy?
Well, no, we did. I did. Okay. I stayed with Dave and Hannah, anxious. We are the anxious alliance. So we stayed together. Yeah. Well, one night we were in. So Adam got a huge suite for him and a handful of other people, and then smaller places for everyone else. And so one night we were eating dinner and hanging out, and Jay and I were both doing tequila shots, and then Jay and I started like fake fighting. But I made the mistake of slapping Jay in the face lightly. I didn't slap him hard. And Jay does not like you to touch his face. And so he hit me back twice in the face really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, we're fighting. We're having a fist fight. So I drop low and I grab Jay and I drive him into the wall. But I don't drive him into a wall. I drive him into like a floor to ceiling
like
length
are
painting.
You being serious? Like you're the real
yeah, like we were fighting.
Okay.
I like got low, wrapped and drove, and I drove him into a wall, but I drove him into like a framed piece of artwork in a Caesar's Palace suite and just shattered the entire
boy.
But thankfully I did not have to pay for it. It was covered. I don't know what happened. I offered to pay for it, yeah. But no bill ever
after
came.
Those hangover movies, they're ready for anything.
Ready for anything. So that happened. This was the genesis of Heek.
Yes.
If you follow my Instagram account,
yes.
which was a ton of fun. And also, I think the reason why Heek was so much fun for me is that there was just so much of a contingent that believed it was real.
Mm-hmm.
And it put into perspective all of the comments that you get on social media that you're like, oh, I really need to not take these so seriously, because a good portion of the people who are tweeting at me actually believe that I'm engaged to Hannah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always in the back of my mind when I read like a silly opinion online. I'm like, you have to put in perspective who is probably saying
this. Good to remember.
You. Yeah.
I have a lot of questions for you from the listeners.
Let's do it.
Okay. All right. This is a good question from William McQuaid, who wants to ask you, Zeke, can you talk through the differences between Sarah's back and forth game strategy and Will Wall's pendulum strategy that led to very different results?
Yeah, I would say
Was Will Wall, should he be getting more credit after the fact for doing what he was doing in Millennials versus Gen X, where we laughed, we scoffed?
Well, I think that the biggest difference, and this is like the essence of all good Survivor gameplay, is it comes down to relationships. And no one has had better Survivor relationships than Sarah, because everybody thought Sarah was their best friend,
mm-hmm.
right? And I don't think Will had that with everyone.
Right.
You know, Will was sort of lured over to one side.
Right.
And it wasn't because, it was because people, I think, were trying to like make a move on Will. Not because Will, and I love Will. Will's a great dude. Will's probably not listening to this.
Why not? What's his problem?
I actually don't talk to Will that much. Will is doing the smart thing,
he is not being
over invested in Survivor. He's going, and I think, you know, had an excellent freshman year at Ohio State, and is you know, putting Survivor in its proper place.
It wouldn't kill him to listen.
I'll text him when we're done. I think it was coming out of Sarah making very precise, you know, surgical maneuvers with these insane relationships that she had with people.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, you guys had that night in the hurricane.
Yes, we did. Will and I.
Yes. Yes.
Will and I had a good relationship. You know, Will and I were buddies. Yeah.
Well, he would have gone to rocks for you.
He did go to rocks.
Once you have that, you know, once you have that, you share a blanket with somebody.
Right. Yeah, you snuggle with a high schooler in your underwear, and you think, you know, what's more unbreakable than that?
Stephanie Bourgeois wants to ask you, did Adam's game influence anything you did in Game Changers?
I don't know if it did, because I think you have to look at it from the perspective. Our perspective was that Dave was the presumptive winner. So if I was looking at anyone's game, I would say it was Dave's. Mm-hmm.
Because going back to the finale, when you had asked Adam about, you know, how do you think you contributed to the way that the game was evolving?
Right.
You know, it seemed like you were at least like thinking in that mindset of, okay, what am I taking away from, you know, the successes here that I might be able to leverage in another season?
Sure. I would say there is a specific reason I asked that question, mm-hmm. but that it was not necessarily because I was... It wasn't necessarily about Adam, Hannah, or Ken.
Okay.
Right. I was sort of contributing to the narrative of the season.
Okay, good. It's a good question, and we also appreciate
the narrative. I also wanted to give a shout-out to my friends.
Of audiobooks, yes. Well, you are an expert at that. That's for sure.
Josh Wiggler.
Yes. Okay.
I didn't have like a big RHAP shout-out in 34, so I had to get it in at the finale.
Appreciate it. Josh Wiggler says, no question, just wanted to give a shout-out to Zeke Smith. There you go.
Hey, baby.
Yeah.
Josh Wiggler.
Okay.
Hey, Wiggler, you know what the offer is, and the offer still stands, and the offer will always stand.
Okay.
You know where I live.
All right. This is a question from Nina. Nina Stoddard wants to ask, despite the history of the moment, did you ever consider not voting Sandra out on the swap tribe? You seem to be the person that was sort of like leading, like, Sandra's never been voted out before. This is our moment. This is our shot.
I would actually say that credit for the Sandra vote goes to Ozzy.
Ozzy.
Yeah, because we threw that challenge. And that Sarah and I were both a little like, oh, gosh, I don't know. But Ozzy was so gung-ho about it.
Not since Billy Garcia has Ozzy said, let's throw the challenge.
Yeah.
Sandra and Billy Garcia, bookends of Ozzy challenge throws.
There we go. Yeah, so I think I got credit. I got narrative credit on that. But no, the big push was behind Ozzy. And I think it's the thing is like, you know, no original Nuku had voted out another original Nuku, and no one wanted to create any waves, especially because anyone who created waves got voted out.
Amy Howard. Your friend.
Yes, Amy is a constant presence, or was a constant presence at my Survivor viewing parties in my apartment.
Zeke, do you think your improv background helped you out there? If so, how?
I do think it helped me out there tremendously. I would say improv helped, like the ability to say yes and to justify anything that anyone says to you helps you a lot at tribal council, or whenever Jeff is asking you questions, or, you know, even in your interviews. And I think that, you know, improv also requires you to be the person the scene needs you to be. And I think that is what I use to build relationships with people. Like, my relationships with Sunday was very different than that with Brett, than that I had with Hannah. And I felt like through improv, I was just able to like be the, you know, the yin to anyone's yang, be the part that completed the relationship and made them comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Would you recommend people take an improv course before they play Survivor?
Yeah, I think improv would be tremendously helpful both before casting and before playing. I mean, I've done
casting. That's, I haven't heard that before.
Well, I think like I said, the quintessential skill is being able to walk in and own a room and being able to think quickly on your feet. And improv, you know, drills you in that. I will say, I hadn't just taken one improv class. I had spent 4 years spending thousands of dollars taking lots of improv classes and doing a ton of improv in New York. So it wasn't just, you know, but Brett did just have a couple of classes and he felt that it had helped him.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
At least it'll help you in the confessionals.
Definitely.
Yeah.
If you want to be asked back, being good television is certainly should be high on your list.
That's a big thing. Okay. Greg wants to know, Greg Feltz, during season 34, did you ever theorize if anybody had the legacy advantage? Did it impact how your long-term in-game thinking was going? What's the best way to play if you know it might exist, but you don't know who has it?
No, I don't believe that I thought anyone had the legacy advantage or that it was part of the game. You know, there are just so many variables about there that you could drive yourself crazy trying to think of all of them, but you'll just drive yourself crazy. I have no advice about how to play with the legacy advantage. I actually was never in the game in which the legacy advantage was utilized. I was always on the jury bench.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw in the Ponderosa clip where you are being told about the Legacy Advantage from Sierra Don Thomas. You're like, ah, yes, I know of it.
Well, I talked about it on the, I told everybody that the Legacy, they were asking, what are the twists of 33? And I told everybody about the Legacy Advantage. And they were like, how was it utilized? And I was like, well, it was like basically a hidden immunity out of Final Five that Ken played and didn't need to.
Mm-hmm. So nobody was concerned about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, there just wasn't anything interesting to say about it.
Apparently, yeah. Matt Price wants to ask you, during the Rock Draw Tribal Council, you said, I reshuffle the deck all the time. It was a great quote, and I wish it got more traction. Is that the Zeke doctrine?
Reshuffling the deck?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the deck reshuffling became a big part of 34, later tribal council in 34. Yeah, I would say for me, I never felt that, and this was often true, anyone I voted with one vote was not necessarily the people I was going to be voting with the next vote. Like, I really feel like for me, I guess Alex Forstenhauser, my survivor tutor, though I don't think he likes credit for that anymore. It was like, you know, there are two types of people in Survivor. There are my allies and my potential allies. And that's how I feel, is like, I'm willing to play with anyone and any vote at any time. I'm not beholden to alliances, which I think makes me a person people do not want to play with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's fun for me.
Yeah. Wow. I've never heard Alex described as your survivor tutor before.
Yes. Alex Forstenhauser, my survivor mentor. We watched a lot of Survivor together, talked through a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I did.
Is he a good mentor? Should other people?
He's a great mentor. I mean, I think, you know, it's unfortunate he will never play, but if he did, he would, I think, be the chosen one. He would be the
prince that was promised.
Yes, he would be the, and he does. I mean, he loves Survivor. He has played. So I have played I played Fake Big Brother and Fake Survivor. I then became the host and have hosted mm-hmm. three games of my own. And Alex has taken home the crown twice.
Yes.
And I would say it's only because he was the Sandra Diaz Twine that he did not win the third game that he played in. But I'm sure he will be redeemed at some point.
And in the Sandra Diaz Twine, in that Ozzy threw a challenge to get him voted out?
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. That's exactly what happened.
Wow. Who knew? John Densford wants to ask you, as a super fan that's now played the game, what's the biggest super fan misconception out there? It can be a gameplay thing or just a new perspective on a past Survivor moment.
Oh, gosh. Well, hey, John, he tweets at me a lot. I've
great,
noticed.
Great guy.
Cool guy. Gosh.
Don't call him Johnny D.
Oh, okay. Well, the biggest misconception, I would say, I think the hard part for me was what you see in an episode, in a 42-minute episode, is basically a one-second highlight clip of a 3.5-hour football game.
Mm-hmm.
And that football game is played from 20 different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And you see one highlight clip that is compiled of 20 different perspectives, but it presents one truth. And I think that's, you will never have as good an understanding of how the game is flowing as you will feel watching it, right? Mm-hmm. Because you only have your perspective, and what you feel and what, you know, anybody else on the tribe feels is the dominant narrative of the game at the time is not necessarily what the dominant narrative will be in that episode. So viewing the game on the sand is a lot different than viewing it, you know, on your couch at home.
Mm-hmm. So you like to compare that football analogy, is the reason why you sort of like feel this connection with the crew. It's like they're the people in the stands. They were watching this game from the 50-yard line the whole way through. They had like the unique ability to see this play out over 39 days and watch it like you would like a football game.
Right. Yeah. They know the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think also, like, you know, they felt that they're with us. You know, they carry, mm-hmm. you know, 40, 50-pound cameras and packs. And, like, every time you see a shot of two people walking down a path or walking in the sand, there are three guys in the sun and the heat walking backwards. You know, and they have 12, insane 12-hour days. Like, they, like, you know, they not only, like, saw it, but they, like, lived it with us.
Jim Rosario wants to ask you, now, you haven't made it to the end. Why is that? You've got a great strategic game and a strong social game. What's the missing piece? If we were going to sort of like do the get Alex Forstenhauser in here, take this, you know, whole game apart. What's the flaw in your game?
I would say it's two things. I think one is that everybody always sees that I have a good social and strategic game. That's tremendously apparent to everyone. And, you know, I think, you know, why Sarah was so successful is she's making all of these huge moves, but no one sees it. Mm-hmm. Right. And when they do start to see it, everyone feels the jury is too bitter against her. And so it, you know, that works in her favor. I would also say, like, I probably start swinging a little too big too early. Mm-hmm. That if I, you know, I think for me, I never felt the confidence that I was ever going to make it to like 6 or 7, that I needed to make a big move in order to get to that point. But I think, yeah, like holding back on like making that big first strike or really like doing a 180 on an ally until a little bit deeper in the game would be necessary.
Now, you've been such an advocate of Sarah. You were so in the Final Tribal Council all the way through on the Ponderosa. She's somebody who did make a lot of swings back and forth. Is the reason why you have been so vocal about Sarah is that you really identify with the way she's played the game?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to have played the game that Sarah played. Mm-hmm. I think Tony is one of my favorite players, if not my favorite. And, you know, Sarah played Tony's game, and it was really cool for me to get to watch Sarah do it. I mean, like I said, I want to go play. I want to go make big moves. I want to have great relationships. And she did all of that, you know, perfectly.
What do the fans not understand about Sarah's game?
Gosh, I don't. Are there I don't know what the vibe is.
You haven't been in the loop, so you don't know necessarily what people think or what they don't.
Is there a knock?
I don't know if it is a knock, but I feel like that even though she made a lot of big swings, where if you looked at them on paper, I feel like that she's not looked at as a flashy player. And which I think probably ultimately serves her well if she returns. But I'm looking forward to doing a deep dive with her into all of this. You talked about Tony as well. I know you're a big Tony fan. Did you have any interaction with him? I know you were never on the same tribe as him.
No, I only met Tony the day of the finale.
Yes.
And I saw him and he goes, Zeke, you know, Tony. And he was like, you would have never voted me out, man. And I was like, yeah, I would have never voted you out. I wanted to play with you. Yeah. So we kind of had a bonding moment. I got a picture with him backstage.
Yes.
I think if one day Tony and I can go be friends, that would be super cool. But no, I didn't get a chance to know him like I would have liked to.
Yeah. I didn't get a chance to see him at the finale either.
I don't think he goes out to the bar after.
No,
because I didn't, you know, he was at the Millennials Gen X finale and I never even met him then.
Yeah.
So.
That's the one time I ever saw him. I shook his hand at the Millennials versus Gen X. Like Team TV.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah. But, you know, great, great dude.
Yeah. Edward Morris wants to know, is there anybody on the original Mana tribe that you would have liked to have played with that you didn't get a chance to?
Well, Tony, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I never got a chance to really play with Aubrey. By the time we got to each other, just we were ships passing in the night. But she's who I wanted to play with going out there. I think we could have made a pretty rad dynamic duo. And had a lot of fun, you know, mixing it up together. So I'm sad I never got to play with her.
Were you able to see all of Koh Rong before you left for the Game Changers?
Oh, geez Louise. We actually went out for Millennials Gen X about like 3 days after Caleb almost died, mm-hmm. which that is not the last Survivor image you want before you go play Survivor.
Yeah.
But then when I got home, actually, Jay and I stole one of the handler's laptops at Ponderosa to watch episodes of Koh Rong because we, as a jury, were not allowed to watch.
Really? Jay was, you know, wanted to watch Survivor on a laptop?
Yeah, well, Jay was the alternate for Koh Rong, so I think he was really curious
was
about
invested.
How it all played out. So I watched a couple of episodes then, and then, you know, I basically watched all of Koh Rong in one day and did not pay a ton of attention, as much attention as I would have liked to study the other plays. But I remember on an interview getting asked about, like, because I was always providing commentary, like, oh, well, this person did this thing in their first season, and now they're doing this. And someone asked me, like, about Ty. And they're like, well, isn't that consistent with what Ty does? And I just looked at them, and I was like, I can't tell you anything about Ty and how he plays.
Right. What does he do?
Right.
So this is from Gregory McBean. Rob talks about how returning players tend to play like the winner of their season. Were there any aspects of Adam's game that you wanted to bring into Game Changers? Was there that I know I asked you before about that there's anything that he contributed to the strategy. Was there anything that like even a small thing that you took away?
Well, there was a thing. I would say, you know, again, I was trying to model, I think, Dave's gameplay a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's just the one, I've been watching Dave as the winner because I didn't, you know, we didn't really know Adam was going to be the winner until we saw the final three. Mm. But I would say the thing I learned from Adam was in my first season, I did a ton of work around camp, and then Adam contributed, I would say, like, you know, about like the minimum average to around camp, like to do enough where no one is upset at you, but also you're not expending a lot of energy doing work around camp. And that's a strategy I took from Adam.
Jason Arick wants to know, how long did it take you to master slide puzzles? Any tips?
Yeah, download an app, and I watched like a 5-minute video on YouTube, which tells you the strategy of how to complete a slide puzzle. So Google slide puzzle strategy, 4x4 is what you need. And practice when you're on the subway.
Megan Elizabeth says, if you can play any other reality TV game show, what would it be and why?
Oh, geez Louise.
Glass House.
No, done. Glass House. Because America votes.
Yes, America. Joy Davis wants to ask you, who is your fashion inspiration?
Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, I see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you a big fan of his?
Yeah, a big Weird Al fan.
Yeah, what's the best Weird Al song?
Oh, gosh. I want to say Amish Paradise because he uses the name Ezekiel in it, and that's a rare shout out.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Is Weird Al still relevant? And he still makes songs.
Yeah, he just dropped an album, I would say, like 2 years ago really good.
Do you think that does Weird Al need to have a stance? Like, I feel like he has a lot of stuff that's just like sort of like rhyming with things, but I don't feel like that he has like a worldview.
You don't think Weird Al has a point of view?
Yeah. Would that help him? Because I feel like that in 1985, okay, that's great. But I wonder, do you need a worldview in 2017 for Weird Al?
You don't need a worldview. You've got a legacy. You're Weird Al.
I guess so.
You know, I just think don't change what you're doing. Everyone loves it.
It's too late.
Yeah. Also, I think he does. I think if you listen to his recent stuff, he does have a bit more of a point
of view.
Listened
to does he have what's his biggest new thing?
Oh gosh, his new album's, not new, I guess it's a couple years old. God, and I don't have the name off the top of my head.
Have you seen him in concert?
I haven't, but it's one of my, it's on my bucket list.
Yeah. I feel like he had a bunch of stuff that came out like all at once, like a few years ago.
Yeah, that's probably, you know, there's a great song called Tacky. There's a new Polka remix. There's like, there's one that I like called Word Crimes, which is a parody of Blurred Lines. Yes. And it's all about grammar.
Yeah.
Yeah. He also, there's one that I'm like super effective. It's super like schlocky, but it's called The Sports Song. And it's like, it's not even a direct parody. It's like a new song set to like marching music about like fan sports songs.
Right. I think I know the words to the, you know, the Don McLean American Pie about as well as I know the words to the Phantom Menace Weird Al song parody.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And then let me give you one more question. Edwin Johnson, what's been the best thing about this entire Survivor experience for you?
Oh, man. I would say...
coming here.
Right, yeah.
That was it.
Yeah, I would say finally, you know, coming to the motherland, coming to the temple in Jerusalem, you know, being in the RHAP podcast studio.
Yes, we did it.
Yeah, we did it, yeah. I see the like the blue stripes on the wall, and I'm just like, oh, and there's the big, like, the TV where you got all the things that come up. Yeah.
Got the things, yeah. What's different about the studio that you thought was going to be?
What is different about the studio? Well, it is... I guess you don't have all the lights on, so it's darker than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah,
it's
can get a little hot. It can get a little hot. It's
it's bigger, like, because there's two parts. There's this part, and then you've got your office
part.
Yeah,
the office.
Yeah, you've got a whole floor up here that's just RHAP land.
Yes. So.
And it was cool. I got to meet Nicole, and I got to meet Reyes.
Yes, yes. I know that my kids might even be home when we get done. You're in for a real treat.
Yeah, the whole Sester Nino experience.
Yeah. What else can we do better on the podcast?
Oh, you're perfect.
I haven't listened in a year.
Okay.
All right.
I will listen to a Wiggle Room every now and again.
Yeah.
My hope is that the Wanda songs, yes, that Wanda decides to return to songwriting and we get a little more Wanda in 35 and 36.
Who's more likely to listen to Survivor 35 RHAP, you or Will Wall?
Will Wall.
Okay.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I love Survivor. I'm definitely going to be watching season 35.
Okay. What are you? You're a hustler?
I'm a hustler.
You might be a hero now.
Gross. Disgusting. Stop it. Wash your mouth out with soap. No, want to know what's funny is I was fussing around with a pilot that I was writing, and okay. sort of about
not a person who flies an airplane,
not a civil air patrol pilot, and it was about coming home from being on a reality show, and the reality show, but you got clips of the reality show. The reality show in question was called Jungle.
Okay.
And the theme of the Jungle season that the lead character was on, and this was written like 5 months ago, was Dreamers, Dealers, and Divas.
Okay. Yes.
I feel like I nailed the season months ago.
You did nail it. Would Survivor Keith deck shufflers it. Be a good season? Should they go do with that?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
It'll
why not?
It'll just be me. I'll play a solo version of Survivor any day.
Yes. Yes.
I just go and win puzzle challenges.
That's good. The one man Survivor. And so you're moving to LA.
Moving to LA. I got some cool stuff in the works.
How soon? How soon are you moving?
Well, it was supposed to be at the 1st of July, but there's a potential that I might be here mid-June.
Okay.
We'll see.
Will I
be insane.
Will I ever see you again, or will you go out of your way to avoid me like the other survivors?
Maybe. You know, I'm leaving my cuddle buddy Josh Wiggler behind, so like yes. someone's got to take his place.
Somebody has to.
So I'm just going
to
okay. be around, get yes. you know, wet, wiggling, get finding that wiggle room between you and Nicole.
I could be the new Will Wall.
You could be the new Will Wall.
Yes,
we okay. could strip down to our undies and snuggle.
She won't be jealous, believe me. Okay. All right, Zeke. Do we have a hashtag today? I know you're not on social media.
Oh gosh, a hashtag? No, I was told to prepare this, and I knew I should, and I don't even think I've had anything like fun that I've said that we could hashtag. Help me out here, bro.
Hashtag Glasshouse Game Changers.
Yeah, Glasshouse Game Changers. I love it. Hashtag Glasshouse Game Changers.
We're bringing it back.
Yes.
We're
you and
back.
I. Maybe, you know, I've hosted the fake games of Big Brother and Survivor. Mm-hmm. We could do a fake glass house.
What do? We have like Periscope going and people are voting for.
Yeah. I mean, I'll leave the technical stuff up to
you.
Will
you do any more fake games?
I don't know. I had this amazing apartment in New York that was immaculate to entertain mm-hmm. in. And I also was best friends with my across the hall neighbors.
Yes.
And they could sort of serve as Ponderosa and you could put people there.
Oh.
And bring them back. Cause it just, you have, you need like two great apartments to entertain in order to do it. I guess, you know, I guess Pav does his outside, but I never. Yeah. I don't know. I got to figure out what is happening in my life and then okay. we'll figure out if
all
there's
right,
fake
we'll figure
Survivor.
It out. I mean, we could send people downstairs here.
Oh, if you want to do it here, if yeah. you're offering up your place, then I will
I
be your
Jeff
Bro.
I don't
know if we
Jeff would get Bro. Enough people, but that.
I could get you a cast together. Okay. Right. I would, as long as I can probst it.
Yes, that's fine. That's fine. We need Alex Forstenhausen to direct. We're getting the band back together. We're doing this. Okay. Zeke Smith, anything you want people to check out or
right now, just follow me on Twitter and Instagram. It's at Zeker Chief.
Is that? What's the origin for that?
They're really...
It's
I
like
just...
handkerchief, but with Zeke?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
I just thought it was cute. Follow me there if you haven't already. Check out my articles on The Hollywood Reporter. Mm-hmm. And yeah, stay tuned.
Okay. All right. Stay tuned for that. Stay tuned for much more going on here on Rob Has a Podcast. Zeke won't be listening, but we will have a lot of fun stuff coming up this week. Our 2000th episode coming up this
Holy
week.
Holy moly.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Do you have a moment that we should pull for the 2000th episode?
Oh, my goodness. Deep dive. I want to see like a little feud between you and Nicole from the early days.
Okay,
do you remember when you and Nicole used to do a podcast giving people relationship advice?
Yes. Rob Has a Love Cast.
Rob Has a Love Cast. I would like to see a Rob Has a Love Cast clip.
Okay. All right. We'll see if we can pull something for that. I mean, if you want a clip of us fighting, I mean, we'll go downstairs. So we'll just,
right. We could just record
just
a new
get,
one.
Just get, you know, get new stuff. And then we have a lot of other fun stuff coming up
this week as well, including a podcast I'm very excited about, the first ever Survivor Hot Takeoff.
Oh.
Yes, we're going to get the hottest takes.
Hot takes.
And we're going to grade them. We're going to grade them. Do you have any Survivor hot takes?
Survivor hot takes. Season 35's theme, we will roll our eyes at initially, but we will fall in love with.
Okay. I don't know if that's, I would grade that as, I'm on the same page with you. So, I don't know if it's that hot of a take, but I do think it's against conventional wisdom. So I'll say it's a pretty medium hot take.
Okay.
Medium hot take.
Well, here's a hotter take. I think that the Heroes tribe of healers, heroes, and hustlers will be better remembered than the Heroes tribe of heroes, villains.
Oh, wow. That's a scorching hot take. Now, the problem is that we have no way of knowing if you're right. You know, it's just like, here's like, you know. Just...
Right. Yes. It's a prediction that would, you know, could only be fulfilled years down the line and no one will remember that I said it at this point.
Right. Right. It's sort of like, you know, when all is said and done, you know, Will Wall will be the greatest American.
And it's he like, will. Okay, Will Wall is a great American.
It's like, okay, but we that's, you're just saying it now. We don't have like, there's no, you can't demonstrably prove it right now. So, we'll see. All right. Looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say in the comments. You can subscribe to the podcast. robiswebsite.com/iTunes. Anything else, E?
No, I think I've talked enough.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate, especially when people come here in the studio and see me. I really appreciate that. It's been so nice to get to catch up. And, you know, that if I didn't make this point during the podcast, you know, in terms of like, everything that, you know, has happened with you that, you know, this ultimately, you know, $1 million is certainly a lot of money. Nothing to sneeze at. The title of Soul Survivor lives forever. But I really believe that for you, that I think that this is going to be. And I said something similar with Aubrey, too. But I believe it. You know, I think that both of you guys are really, you know, talented people. I think that you're going to go on to really great success. And, you know, congratulations on everything.
Oh, thanks, Rob. It means a lot.
All right. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.